Now you have the opportunity to buy a unique poster containing a screenshot of every single millennial stream ever. The entire smorgasbord, the full gamut, the whole shebang, all in one incredible display commemorating the first decade of this festival. Available in portrait or landscape. Buy yours now. Your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. And we're now doing a new thing that I've never done this before, at least not quite like this, the banquets. There are going to be six of these, and this is the first one with representing the Germanosphere. So we have people from Austria, Germany, and Swiss Germany. So this should be quite interesting. We're going to talk about, that's the thing. I don't quite know how this is going to be, but I'm going to try to make it informal and easygoing and relaxed. So I should say that we have Cult Games, TMOS Magazine, Niels Wegner, and Martin Lichtmess. TMOS Magazine have appeared on Millennial before. I think they'll all be familiar to you. So here we go. Welcome, all of you. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening.
Howdy.
Excellent.
Hi.
Hello. So with that intro said, I'll just let you speak about the year's events. I would like to ask... Niels, we'll go with you first. What would you say about 2024 so far, just to get us started? What are the most important events this year, do you think?
Oh, well, the most important events in world history, I guess, are obviously the American election, the toppling of Assad during the past few weeks as a part of this whole Mid-Eastern complex of geopolitical shift that's been going on. Since the Ukraine war is still dragging along, I guess there's not that much of a special event to talk about. And besides that, in Germany, we have had some elections that were pretty important. We will have another national election, a snap election, coming in February. All over Europe, there have been some quite important elections on a national level that usually brought huge right-wing shifts that were more or less expected. And besides that, on a personal level, it's just been the usual stuff, some publishing going on, some copywriting and sub-editing and proofreading going on, and besides that, watching the whole matter both nationally and internationally unfold.
All right. I meant really with regard to the Germanosphere, because I think there obviously is a language barrier, but I think also within English-speaking countries, people are so obsessed with America. I guess we're all obsessed with America, but it drowns out other countries. Here's one thing that I think a lot of people would want to ask. All of you can just say what you want here. The AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, is that How big a threat is that party to the status quo in Germany? Lichtmess, do you want to go first?
I had to turn on the sound. Well, I'm not the... So I'm not the... the damn, sorry. I have some irritation on my computer. I'm not the German faction. So, I mean, maybe you should rather ask me about Austria, Freedom Party, Kickl and so. And maybe ask Niels more about AfD. So we can have
all right. Okay, then we'll take Niels.
You know, the Reichself, this has to be divided properly.
All right, then. Niels, what would you say about the AfD?
Okay, speaking for the Reich proper, right? On one hand, of course, it's a very potent opposition party. But as the recent state elections have shown, it is more or less just a matter of time, given let's call it fair circumstances, that they will have to sooner or later prove themselves within a state or even national government. And to this end, they will have to find one or two other parties that would be willing to cooperate with them within a given government. Because of our election system, it's more or less impossible and just nothing to fantasize about that they could mount a one-party government at any given time. And this is probably not going to happen under any given circumstance at any given time, looking from this point in time. And they have been able to mount ever more pressure on the ruling parties, which are the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, the so-called Free Democrats, which is something like a castrated libertarian party, very loosely put, and the post-communist Linke left-wing party. But all in all, those other four parties will always be and have always been willing to, when push comes to shove, mount a coalition of the Democrats against AfD. And this is not going to change anytime soon, as far as I can see. So they will be relegated to an opposition function, which is what they do best, I believe, at least up to now and for the foreseeable future. That does not hinder some of their rather liberal chief politicians to always try and convince their own party colleagues and as well the politicians of other parties, especially the Christian Democrats, which are the more or less token conservatives within the democratic German party spectrum, that it would not only be feasible, but also necessary to actually depict and realize the voters' will in a democratic way and to eventually merge their powers together and govern as a coalition government. But given the respect of the named so-called democratic parties for the voters' will in the past, that's surely not going to be too convincing, not even factoring in any special interest groups that might be mounting pressure as well. So the AfD should and probably will have no other choice than to do what it does best and kind of push the other parties towards at least some topics and decisions to a certain degree that they would like to realize themselves, especially when it comes to questions of immigration, to deportations of especially criminal foreigners that are already inside Germany, and other topics that more or less are fitting to a large degree protest party, as the AfD still is.
All right, but if they are relegated, if the other parties combine to keep them down, doesn't that just confirm for the public that it is the corruption of the system?
It obviously does, but nonetheless, due to our electoral system and the traditional parties with their followers, at least those that are convinced and would vote Christian Democrat or Social Democrat, no matter what their given platform for an election would be, there is no other option than to eventually form a coalition government if the election results are to that degree. And neither the Christian Democrats nor the Social Democrats would be willing now, and as I said, in the foreseeable future, would be willing to form a coalition government with AfD, because they would kind of be marked as the ones that opened the gates of hell, so to speak.
So
this is actually the wording that is used in this context.
Amazing. So what that means is that it's sort of certain then that the AfD will just continue to grow because it will continue to be oppressed. I mean, I'm guessing the public will obviously see what's going on here, and that will actually get sympathy for the AfD, I would think.
That's very probable, and especially regarding growth in membership and in voter sympathy, I believe it's better to stay in an opposition position, because there you are way more free to articulate your stances and propagandize against the ruling parties. On the other hand, obviously the other parties and their attached experts know that as well. So once again, there has been talk about getting into a ban motion against the AfD, and now for the first time it actually might happen, although personally I'm still not too convinced about that, because due to our system regarding party bans, it is very time-consuming and very complicated, such a motion at the Constitutional Court. And if that motion would fail, it would, what many of the so-called Democratic parties and their lawyers and experts fear, it would embolden AfD even more. So if one such motion is actually put in place, it is more or less forced to go through. Because back in the day, against the last more or less successful, let's say, nationalists and or patriotic party, the NPD, that has now rebranded itself as Die Heimat, the homeland, they tried twice to ban this party since the 2000s. And at the first time, the court dismissed the motion because it was found out that many, if not most, of the key positions in the party were actually manned by paid informants of the domestic intelligence services. And at the second time, the court chose to declare the party's aims unconstitutional, but to not ban it because it had no chance to ever realize those aims. And they used this ruling to, at the same time, declare the notion of the German people as being biologically or genetically or in any way materialistically defined as being unconstitutional. So they more or less used this court case against this party to ban a concept of a people instead. So now any party or even a simple union of any kind that expresses the notion that the German people is constituted by, let's say, people that are related to other people that have been living in Germany for at least 200 to 500 years or so, that being biological Germans, uttering that and putting that into your agenda as a political or even private association of any kind would get you banned by ruling of our federal constitutional court, because naming the German people as a biological or racial or what have you entity is by now declared unconstitutional. The German people is just the holistic entity of all people that bear a German passport, and that's it.
Yeah, I think I heard quotes from Merkel to that effect, that it's just someone who has a German passport. And we hear similar things in Britain, of course. All right, Roland, what about, before I get to, there are some other more informal questions later on, but I'll ask you, because I know that Roland might not be able to stay forever, but for the whole length of this, because he's not very well. Oh, I should have said at the start that Martin Selner couldn't make it because he's not very well. Quite a few people have the flu, unfortunately. So we'll have to just bear with that. But so Roland from Cult Games, what about the FPO in the Freedom Party in Austria? And obviously Lichtmes can chime in here as well. What would you say about its situation now, given the rise of the AfD in Germany? I'm just wondering if there's a connection here, if the similar things are happening in both countries. I think he might be muted.
I was muted, yeah.
Right, okay.
So the FPÖ has actually has been very successful in the last elections. It actually had its, as far as I know, best election result it ever had. But it did not get into the government because, of course, again, just as Nils said, what happened with AfD happened here, that they did not get picked by any coalition partners and will have to remain in the opposition. And we are still in coalition talks. They are dragging on because, of course, now all the other parties are trying somehow to get to get together and figure out what coalition to form, which will be interesting to see. I think it will be very unstable, but we'll see. So, yeah, they have been successfully kept out in that sense. But again, I also think the FPÖ is better in opposition than it is in the government. I mean, the thing is that the FPÖ now has a relatively competent head with Kicke, who is definitely... Yeah, smarter and not as easy to to manage maybe as Hatzi Strache has been. in the last in the last time the FPÖ was in the government. Yeah. So that was probably the most important thing that happened in Austria this year. I'm not sure how much the AfD like directly influences here. The FPÖ is of course a much older party than the AfD and has existed for a much longer time, and is more established. It's not the AfD is a relatively new phenomenon, and it's much more. I think my impression as an Austrian is that, of course, if you're an FPÖ voter, you might also get there will also be people antagonistic towards you. I've moved to the countryside some time ago, and it is definitely less pronounced here than in the cities. But it's still not as bad, I think, as it is with the AfD. I think if you're publicly outed as an AfD voter in Germany, you will face more severe, you will be ostracized even more severe than here in Germany if you're an FPÖ supporter, for sure.
That's terrible. Because it must be a lot of people who are AfD voters. So.
Yeah. But the in Germany, that is my impression as an Austrian. It's really there is a very strong, also very violent Antifa. There is like the whole media apparatus is much more. I think there is just a stronger sense that if you are an AfD voter, you're essentially, you're. What's the word? The English word? You can basically, they can do to you whatever they want. Essentially, you're an outlaw, basically.
Well, that was something that I was hoping would come up, because it seems to me that the natural collectivism of the German people is being used against them. To make them destroy themselves. Lechmes, is there anything you'd like to say about the FPÖ before we go on?
You want to go on already? I could say a few things about FPÖ. Well, as Roland said, they have been part of the game, sort of. So they are not. It's not that bad if you are FPÖ. When you are AfD in Austria, so in a way they have been part of the gang for decades. They cannot be completely outlawed, and of course what happened was expected. Okay, I must say I didn't expect so much of a win. It was a really landslide victory for
Kickers. Yeah, that's true. That was actually surprising. I mean, I also thought they would win, but.
Yeah,
that was a pretty clear sign that the more hardline stance that Kickl, because it was a bit interesting. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, Martin, just very briefly. But it was surprising, almost that was a bit of a white pill, because there was the whole thing like, Kickl is too radical. He will scare away. He will scare away the voters. But actually, totally the opposite happened. Like, people liked the radical hardline course of Kickl, as has been shown in this election.
The thing is, I mean, I don't care much about elections, because it's always the same Groundhog Day game. So you get FPÖ, they get about 20 plus percent of the votes, and then sometimes they're closer, sometimes they're a bit far away. In 2017, they finally made it into the government. But this government was bombed, if you remember, by some intrigue. In any case, I mean, they did have Kickl in the government back then. This is the one guy they wanted to get rid of. He was Minister of the Interior, and they really were scared of him, I think. They didn't care about Strache, because he was just the sidekick of Kurz. And but when they got rid of Strache, they also got rid of Kickl back then. So I don't know. There's always this ever same frustration, like a Fata Morgana. And I also know the all my hoodies, they wait for, oh, finally we get there, finally we get closer, and it's ever vanishing. It's like a fruit you cannot ever get. So I'm already sort of numbed to this kind of thing, but I was positively surprised how much success Kickl had. So finally I was delighted, but I knew they would do everything to keep him out, which is also putting a bad light on them. I mean, by now the Freedom Party polls, they according to polls, they are even more popular than before the election. And it seems really an outrageous thing to do, to really do anything to keep the strongest party in the country out of power, and also to keep the same, basically the same people in charge. So, I mean, like the arch enemy of Kickl, it was Chancellor Nehammer. And all this dates back to the COVID, charade. And I think also COVID played a large role in this election. It was a payoff, you know, by things that were inflicted by this very same government, by the center-right Kax ÖVP party, especially Chancellor Nehammer, who got a start as a minister of the interior, and he was very nasty on protesters and all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is a guy I absolutely hate. I mean, when I see this stupid face, I get into fed posting mode. It's still a trauma from back from the COVID times. You know, I was joining the protests, and I remember how the government. And he became chancellor. It was in the final days of the COVID regime, but he was already implied. And I think I agree with many analysts that Kickl, who took a principal stance against the COVID measures and against vaccine mandates, he really gained a lot now in the long run because he did that. I remember back then when the whole drama was on, that Kickl was the politician they shat on the most, you know. So he was every week, I remember he was in the tabloid paper polls, who are the least popular politicians of Austria, and there would also always be Kickl, and he would take the stance. And now, after people have realized that something was really fishy here, something went wrong, even people who were in at this thing back then, many have changed their minds. So Kickl has now a much better position, and I think this was the revenge, you know, of people who got traumatized during the COVID time. I mean, of course, other things play a part, like people don't want immigration anymore and all these kind of things. Certainly. I mean, if Martin Selner was here, he would emphasize this thing, and he's not wrong, but I am emphasizing the other thing. I think it's a sort of payoff from the COVID thing. And certainly, I mean, the whole drama, the whole charade of this democratic system, which has become a meme, is again apparent, you know, by all these efforts to keep Kickl out of the government. And even Nehammer, the chancellor, he's not retiring from his post as head of the party, which he should, because he's responsible for the biggest disaster this party has had in ever since it existed. I think they have never ever lost so many voters, and similar or same things are true for Social Democrats. You know, Social Democrats and ÖVP, they were the ones who split the cake. You know, it was the typical post-war pattern where you have a socialist party and you have a Christ Democratic Party, and they split up the cake. And this was the thing in Austria. And ever since the 1990s, when Haider reformed the Freedom Party and made it a populist party, ever since then, they have been, you know, chased like in the Nordic sagas, when the wolf chases the sun. It's like, was like the Freedom Party after their ass, and so and they never get rid of that wolf again. The wolf is at their asses all the time ever since the 1990s, and they will never ever get rid of it again. And this time they lost bigly, And now they make a really bad impression to the voters by keeping Kickl completely out of the government. So this is good because it makes them look bad. It creates more mistrust in them, which they deserve because they have abused the trust people had in them. And also they are now here with a bunch of problems, for example, financial budgetary problems. And this is one thing why I think Kickl is in some way lucky that this happens now for a long run. Now, I always wanted him to stay clean, pure. Now, I think the moment he gets into government, he will be compromised, or he will have to do compromises. He will have to, he will not be able to change the complete system. He won't be able to work miracles. Inevitably, some disappointment will follow. So I want him to stay in the opposition, to be pure and to be, you know, a pain in their ass, which he is in a very, very good way, because he's clever and he's uncorruptible. And also he has now, he can lean back and watch how these guys are even more discrediting themselves and how they are dealing with problems he hasn't to deal right now. You know, he hasn't to deal with the budget problems and anything else. So this coalition, this government is doomed anyway, you know. So it will be in the long run even good for the Freedom Party. You know? And of course, when I say I want him to stay pure in opposition, certainly I also do want things to change. You know, I want somebody to be in charge and say, let's push for, closed borders or emigrations or COVID reparations or whatever. I really want that. But I have become so pessimist and black-pilled that whenever we get some right-wing politician in power and voted, he or she will be a complete disappointment, you see. So these are my basic thoughts. I mean, I could say much more about that, but I don't want to take up all the time. But these are my most important thoughts about Kickl and Freedom Party at the moment.
All right. Roland, do you have anything to say about this? Are you more optimistic than Lichtmess?
I'm not really. I mean... I have to admit that I also mostly checked out of party politics, to be quite honest, because, yeah, I mean, what can I say? What can I add to what Martin said? I mean, it is at the end of the day, it is a bit of a charade, a theater, and it was not surprising that exactly what happened would happen with the FPÖ. So... yeah, I think the current situation is actually... I mean, that sounds like I'm like blackpilled or something, but I'm actually not completely like... the current situation is really not so bad. And I'm looking forward to, the disintegration of whatever government will come next. So that will be...
I want them to look bad, even possible, more possible. I want them to look like democracy is just... the system we rig in our for our purpose. See, you can vote as much as you like. We will always make it so that we will stay in charge, and there will not be any change. And it has become so obvious, so transparent. It's almost I almost enjoy it. You know, it's almost a kind of a pleasure to see how these guys discredit themselves. Yeah. You know? Especially this guy in charge, Nehammer. Did I mention I hate him? I really hate him.
yeah, he's horrible. He's also just so stupid, and he has such a stupid face. Yeah, he's enraging. I more than the actual tangible political benefits, I almost enjoy the, I guess you could say, metapolitical aspects of it, in the sense that, yeah, everything gets more and more discredited. You can... I feel be more open about how much everything is just bullshit in your everyday life, and people will, silently or not so silently agree with you. So that feels kind of good, especially after having all these years, you know, with the COVID lockdowns and everything, where there was this air of repression and kind of oppression.
And this was the basis of this major loss of trust in politicians and in media and experts and in institutions. I mean, some of us have lost this trust far ago. There have always been these waves of trust losing and disintegration of trust in refugee crisis and even before. So this was a major wave, and I don't think it cannot be ever repaired. And I'm glad about that.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe we should.
Sorry.
Get back. Don't worry. Stefan, I wanted to ask you about, we've heard from about Germany and Austria. Would you say that Switzerland is free from these problems? Or it does seem to be a very unique country. Definitely not.
Okay. No, I mean, Switzerland, I think Switzerland actually really is the best country in Western Europe, but we suffer from the same problems as all our neighbors do. I think even Jean Raspail wrote in his book, Le Champ de Science, the attack of the... I think you know what I'm talking about. Even in this book, he brought it very good to the letter that in the end, even Switzerland falls. And so we suffer from the same problem as the Germans do, as the Austrians do. But, you know, Switzerland is like the place where the white flight is happening. So all the good educated people from Austria, especially from Germany, as well from France and Italy, they all escape to Switzerland because they can gain here much more wealth. We're just a safe and still pretty white country. But on the long term, we face the same problems as our neighbors do. I mean, all European nations suffer from the same problems because all of Europe always follows the three leading nations. It's Germany, France, and England. So if we talk about Swiss politics, it's actually, there's not so much to talk about, to be honest, because as you could hear from Roland and as well from Martin, like Corona and the whole COVID stuff has been, that's such a big thing to them. And as well in Switzerland, it has been a big thing. Okay. But we didn't have like a COVID regime. We didn't have such a pressure with the vaccines and all the restrictions. And I mean, up to today, we do not even experience a single Islamic terrorist attack, for example. And so we have like the same problems as they do, but we suffer not so much as they do. So we're still best off in Western Europe, I think. When we talk now about the first question you ask, Niels, what was the most important happening, or what was the most important thing that happened in the Germanosphere in this year, 2024? That actually happened in January, and that has also been the most important political event in Switzerland for this year. And it's all tied with your guest, who is not here today, sadly, Martin Zellner. Because Martin spoke two times this year about remigration in Switzerland, and both times he got expelled from our country, which is absolutely crazy. I think this never happened in Swiss history, like in the last 60 years before, that someone got shut down when he tried to hold a speech and got deported from the country. And Martin was deported for hate speech because he wanted to talk there about remigration. And this was, like Neil said, we had some local elections in Thüringen, we had a national election in Austria, and there were interesting happenings. But the year 2024 started actually with the, and I think even you in the Anglosphere heard about it, it started with this whole Potsdam conspiracy inside job the media and the government made up, where they said there was this far-right Nazi conspiracy meeting in Potsdam where they discussed, like, they literally talked about its WANSEE conference 2.0. Its plans about mass deportations, because when that started in January, there was a big hysteria all in all of the media, in as well, even in Switzerland, but especially in Germany. I mean, in Germany, it even got that far that, like, unique, I think, worldwide, the government started protests against the opposition, and 10,000, even hundreds of thousands of people were protesting on the streets against AfD and against remigration and against this whole conspiracy, the so-called conspiracy meeting. I mean, actually, if Martin would be here, he could tell us about it more. They just met like 50 people, and they just talked about political solutions for the problems of our time. And I think actually that was the major happening in the Germano-speaking sphere. This really caused so much trouble, and as well, they tried to make this up to weaken the AfD in these small elections that were held. And I think your first question to Niels has been, how dangerous is the AfD to the government? I mean, Niels explained it perfectly. The AfD, they won't really change something on a political level, but the most important thing about the AfD is that they're just a right-wing party, and they speak out right-wing thoughts, and they can just work out of opposition. That's the best thing you can actually do right now. And especially, I think, even for people from America and England, it's hard to get how much of a revolution this is in Germany. Because in Germany, before the AfD was founded, there was literally no right-wing party. There was, as well, not really a libertarian party, not established. I mean, there always were some, but they always were lost after some years. And now with the AfD, finally, he's here. And now with the AfD...
Welcome, dear Schattenmacher, just to say. Stefan, yeah. Please continue.
Yeah, welcome. Yeah, welcome, Schatti.
Yeah, I hope you can hear me. Sorry for the delay.
Yes, don't worry about it. Yeah. It's okay.
So from the outside perspective, I mean, from the outside, from the Swiss perspective, that's really the best thing both of these parties in Austria and in Germany can do, is just to do like the metapolitical part, because they won't really gain sustainable political power. They won't really be able to change something. And yeah, I would as well join the analysis of Martin. Even if we talk about who should this party or the other party, they have now to win the election, then anything will be good. Well, I'm not very convinced about this deep democratical thought, because you always see how they all get corrupted. And I mean, we will see now within the next 4 years with Trump. If elections alone really can bring, or really can turn the tide.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Der Schattenmacher, welcome. We were talking about Germany before with Niels. Then we talked about Austria. And then I just asked Stefan there about Switzerland. To warm you up, I'll go ask you a question, and Niels can chip in here as well if he wants. I saw a clip recently with Angela Merkel, and she was asked whether she regretted the migrant crisis in 2015, whether she regretted opening the doors to all the refugees in 2015. And she said, and this was a few weeks ago, maybe you'll have heard about this, she said that no, she would regret it more if she hadn't done it. So, Niels and Schattenmacher, please, could you talk about Angela Merkel, how she is viewed today. She's been out of power for 3 years, and what her legacy will be, and how the refugee crisis has affected Germany. Schattenmacher, would you take that first?
Yeah. Sorry again for the delay. I mean, I'm with my parents over Christmas, so I came in 40 minutes late. But to answer your question about Angela Merkel, well, it obviously depends strongly on who you ask what her legacy will be. Firstly, I'm rather blackpilled a little because I can even see it in myself that the visceral anger I would feel about her has dampened down just because she is not in the limelight anymore. I mean, she's as guilty as it gets when it comes to the decline of Germany. But if you don't see anybody being responsible every day, then your natural response is not to live in anger, in this sharp form of anger, for all these years. So the feelings become more of a rational response to what she did. And I think if this is a phenomenon even with me, then it is probably much stronger with the general population. I mean, I would assume that in the CDU, her party, she could now run as a presidential candidate and she would not fare much worse than the current candidate Friedrich Merz. I think she could do it and it wouldn't be a change of note. Now, her legacy is disastrous, that is true, but I also think that her opinion about the matters of immigration become even more entrenched, even more strongly pro-immigration, is a consequence of her surroundings. I mean, she can encapsulate herself with people that completely agree with her or that would never dare to criticize her openly about what she has done. And I think it's very easy to believe your own hype, to believe that your deeds were good. If you are in this situation, she recently published her book, probably got a lot of money in preprint for that. I mean, there is, without outside pressure, the only, influence that can change your personal outlook on something is something like an epiphany, a moral conviction from within yourself. And although this is probably a force that exists among humanity, I think most people start regretting when they feel consequences. And since she has felt none, she won't. And speaking realistically, she will go to the grave undefeated. I mean, as much as we would wish it to be otherwise, it likely won't be the case. I mean, she's, 60 or 70 years now? Probably 70 years now, something like this. And it is unlikely that we will have in the next 15 years the big trial to avenge ourselves against Angela Merkel.
Right, okay. Niels, would you like to chip in here about this, about the refugee crisis, how it has changed Germany over the last 10 years and Angela Merkel?
Well, personally, I would say that during her reign, the full 16 years of it, it became quite clear, especially after 2015 and the opening of the floodgates towards the refugees and the educated workers that we obviously need so much, that Angela Merkel was becoming sort of an avatar of the system itself and the face of a system. But everyone, especially those who were protesting against it, were mainly focusing on her because she was the face of this policy. She was at the helm of all those governments, all those successive governments. But one, she was not the only one making those decisions. Most of those she at least sympathized with, but by far did not bring everyone to helm, and everyone was just obeying her command. But there were several other politicians that mostly are still in business and are not as much antagonized or antagonizing the electorate as she has been during her political times. And on the other hand, now that she's gone, and especially in the later years of her last government, she actually managed to antagonize the electorate so much that in 2021, they chose to vote for the Social Democrats instead, to just to get her and her party out of power. Somewhat ignorant to the fact that during 12 years of the 16 years that Angela Merkel was the Chancellor of Germany, the Social Democrats were actually in a coalition with her Christian Democrats and were thus also responsible for all the political decisions she made or that were made during her reign. And that was by far not only opening the gates for foreigners of all kinds to come in and seek a happy life by leeching off the German taxpayer, but the German military was ruined for good during her reign. It was not something that started during that time, but already started in the early 90s after the Soviet bloc collapsed, but was finished off during, I believe it was the second term of Merkel as a chancellor. All those, pretty much all those political developments that culminated over the past 4 years with the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democrats in power were pretty much started, or the groundwork for that was laid during Angela Merkel's reign. And now the other parties, the former more or less opposition parties that were voted to reign or chose to work together to keep the AfD as an opposition party out, are now reaping the bitter fruits of what Merkel started and her co-conspirators started back in the day. So I believe it's easy, but a little too easy to just focus on her as the devil incarnate of this political development that we've seen for almost 20 years now. As I said, it's not just from 2015 on, but we've been experiencing that in Germany for quite a while longer. The migrant crisis in and of itself was obviously a push in the right direction for the electorate to see that it is being led on and that the media is in bed with politics and not at all acting as some sort of force of checks and balances to control and maybe even sometimes correct what the politicians are doing, but that they're willing to blatantly lie, to tell everyone that their lying eyes are deceiving them, they should trust the experts and follow the science and stuff like that. And pretty much the migrant crisis and especially the media reaction towards it was kind of a precursor to the culmination during the COVID crisis with regards to how untrustworthy the media actually is, especially the state-financed media, and what the electorate and the individual citizen of German descent could or had to actually think about this so-called democratic government. But all this that could have been understood has not yet manifested in election results and other manifests results as we as dissidents and as opposition would probably wish for. There's still much of a certain gravity and a certain one might call it laziness within the electorate to make some decisions that might seem revolutionary or unheard of to some. Maybe in part due to the demographic change that all Western countries are now faced with, because it's actually the more or less old geezers that are now making up most of the election results, and those are certainly not people that are willing to get too revolutionary in their golden years. But in and of itself, had there not been the COVID crisis, we would have seen the migrant crisis as the only but significant event to drive a wedge between media, both private media and state-sponsored media, the politicians that are both hounded and sometimes led on by the media, but also dictate most of the narratives the media is there to promulgate, and the electorate and the consumers of said media. So at least in this case, although it did not manifest in any actual and tangible political change, it's been a very important development, although it has come at quite the high cost and still does, as we have seen just a few days ago regarding the Magdeburg event.
Well, yes, indeed. And that seems to go on. And
although,
on.
Obviously, this guy that drove into the Christmas market in Magdeburg has not come into Germany due to the opening of the borders in 2015, but was himself advocating for an even less strict immigration policy for Germany.
Yeah, he'd been there since 2006. And I think got his citizenship in 2016, if I recall correctly. But yeah, it's a general point that the more of these people there are in Germany, the more terrorist attacks happen. I remember in 2016 there were many in that year, in that summer alone, and it was astonishing. So, would you say that the migrant crisis? Because this is how it seems to me, that the migrant crisis was decided upon, or rather opening the gates, that was decided upon. There was no debate at all. And then the job of the media was simply to make the public go along with that. And that was really what the media did at that time. That's how it was in Britain, at least. Schattenmacher.
Yes. I mean, it's still an open question how the migrant crisis was decided, how the COVID crisis was decided. I mean, there are competing theories and we can never come to a true conclusion. I mean, there is the, let's say, more conspiratorial theory that really people have deep plans in the background and it cannot be completely ruled out. I mean, sure, the stockholders of big pharmaceutical companies maybe did make concrete plans. And also concerning the migrant crisis, maybe there were some people who had these plans. But then also there's the other faction that say, or that have the theory that things just happen. And due to the general moral tone that is set by the media and by the university, basically since the end of the Second World War, these things are just allowed to happen. And I don't know what is true. I have a slight tendency to believe the latter, or a mixture of both, and I'm generally relatively careful about this because I don't know. But yeah, what were the consequences? I mean, the consequences were something like probably Nassim Nicholas Taleb would call or would describe in his book about anti-fragility, that, I mean, if you boil the frog slow enough, the response is disproportionately low. But if you do then a disenfranchising action that is hard enough in consequence, then people start to disenfranchising from the system. I think we have seen several such encounters in the last 20 years. I mean, we started with the economic crisis, then Ukraine in 2014, then big part was the migrant crisis, then Corona or COVID. Then and now we have maybe Ukraine part two or something like this. But I think the two biggest ones were Corona or COVID and the migrant crisis. Yeah, that's from my part how it happened. And as Niels said, I mean, it's not just Angela Merkel. And I think that people have a feeling for that the system is basically made up of 500,000 bureaucrats or so. And you cannot get rid of them all by just voting or by just one terror attack or so. I mean, how a regime change in Germany of a fundamental nature would even look like, I think nobody can imagine. And if somebody could imagine it, we would see a movie about this. And that, and because we don't see a movie, it's indicative of the political system that we live in.
Yeah, it feels like something from an over-the-top film, but actually it's reality. This is how it works. It's so strange. And it's not how the media is supposed to work. It's not how politics is supposed to work. But it seems to be how, in this day and age, it does work. Lichtmess, would you like to say anything about this? Obviously, Merkel is just one figure. And she might not have any or have had any influence at all. She might have just followed orders, so to speak. But what would you say about her legacy and the way she's going to be remembered?
How badly? I mean, there's of course this overestimation of individuals or certain faces that embody or symbolize the evil that's going on in our age. And it's only natural that people would assume that, because the way power works in today's world is much more subtle. I mean, you cut off one head and you get another one or three other ones grown from the same root, from the same source, like the mythical serpent, the Hydra. So certainly this is the case. And all I can say is I remember how fervent this hatred of Angela Merkel was in a certain bubble, both during migrant crisis and during COVID. She was one of those politicians that were very, very scared of the virus. And so she took painstaking measures to follow the rules and to impose the rules. So she was one of those that were true believers, I think. So she got a lot of hatred, and people would have the slogan Merkel muss weg, right? And then in Austria we had Kurz muss weg. Now they are all gone, but there's not really much change. And in Germany, it's almost a comedy. You have even much worse people than before. Don't get me started there. Maybe we shouldn't waste our time on these people. But yeah, of course, there she is, and she's just an empty shell, okay? I mean, I don't think she has any deep conviction. She's a conformist. I mean, but she's also not... People tried very hard to make her look evil and bad. And this is one thing that is also natural. You have these ruling elites, and they are all posing as do-gooders. They want to do good things. Merkel would talk to you like she's this, politically correct auntie that would talk to school children and tell them what to do, how to be nice and not be naughty, in this passive, aggressive, nurse wretched kind of style. So it would make you mad, you know, but I don't think there was much behind it. She wasn't malicious or so. She was just like a, how shall I put it? She was like a creature from the zeitgeist, almost like a golem or something. This is the way I see her. I mean, she looks like there's this funny word for fat people, butter golem in German. So I like it. So she's like a butter golem, and she has had these ridiculous dresses. You see, I tend to get very personal as well when I talk about politicians, but I'm also aware that they are just these heads of the Hydra.
Hold on. Roland is going to have to check out now because he's not feeling very well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
It did occur to me, Lichtmess, when you were saying that people tried to make Merkel look very bad. I thought, well, Roland did a good job of that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I made like a kind of... I immortalized her in my game, so...
I hope this will be remembered about her, you know?
Yeah!
And if I'm very optimistic, very white-pilled, I hope... Oh, Merkel, she was that hideous monster in that great game back from the 2020s. this would be a great future to look forward to.
No, I mean, so. The good thing is, like, if you make dystopian video games, it is like you have like an endless array of grotesque people to choose to pick and choose from, like a rogues gallery. Yeah. So I guess that's for me personally, that's the positive aspect of it all. Yeah, like the.
All right.
The horrors never end. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm going to retire now to bed and drink some more tea.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Have a nice evening, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. So, Lichtmess, you were in the middle of a rant there. I'm sorry I had to interrupt.
I don't want to go into that too much, but of course, also during COVID, there was this one face for evil, which was Klaus Schwab. He was a perfect villain. The way he looked, the way he talked, also Bill Gates, less so. But you needed some embodiment, some face for this evil. I mean, the way I see it now, of course, World Economic Forum is a powerful organization. They are powerful people. They drive agendas. In regard to COVID, I think they were just followers. They were just trying to sort of make something out of it, but they were not the ones who caused it. But anyway, you needed a villain. You needed a face to attack. It's just human. And the same was, these people make good villains to give them that credit.
They
are stupid, ugly. They're like cartoon characters. In Germany, there were some great people in that respect. Karl Lauterbach, who was the health minister, he looked like a decaying corpse with rotting teeth, and he had this psychiatry, like he came from a psychiatry, and he was supposed to teach you about health. It was fantastic satire, comedy in a respect, but of course it's a mistake to focus too much on these faces of the Hydra and these protagonists. Because they are gone now. They're gone now, and still the system goes on and on. So, and the bureaucrats, as Shati mentioned, they don't make so interesting villains. But I guess I think in COVID it was the bureaucrats you didn't see that were the most vicious villains, the ones to blame, you see.
Well,
but this is another. Yeah.
This was from Germany during COVID.
Yeah. This is so fucked.
Yeah.
Beyond belief. Yeah. So, yeah, that would be my point about that, the personifications of evil. And so.
You could relate that the Iranian scapegoat as well, because I guess now that everyone has taken some interest in Peter Thiel within the past few years, most of the people might have heard about that whole scapegoat concept as well. And all of this blaming certain phenomena on a single person with the hopes to get rid of them due to elections or what have you is more or less just a somewhat religious service, that everything that is wrong within the community is blamed on one single person, or as it was in ancient times, an actual scapegoat, that is a goat that is that all the sins of the members of the community were written upon, and then this goat was chased away into the desert, so the sins were gone and everyone was able to start fresh and live with each other without always thinking about what all the other people have done wrong. And more or less, in political terms, it's just the same thing, to not having to admit to oneself that maybe not just one political official and maybe his personal minions are the ones causing all this trouble, but the system in and of itself is rotten from the inside, and by trying to vote that very evil singular person away, one is actually just partaking in prolonging the whole suffering.
Well, on that note, here are some super chats to do with the situation in Germany and in Austria. I'll go with the Austrian ones first. Thin Red Line asks, many people in the rest of the West feel that the... Oh, sorry, hold on a second. Darby said, will the Austrian Freedom Party be able to govern as the sole ruling party in the future? Or will they have to work within a coalition like many of the other rising right-wing parties in Europe? Well, Lichtmes, you take that first.
Well, everybody will have to work in a coalition. I don't see any other way. I mean, it's utopian. They would get a large, huge majority where they can rule alone. I mean, we had that in Austria, in fact, for about 20 years or so. The Socialist Party had completely owned the government all alone in the 1970s and early 80s or so. So technically it's possible, but I don't think Freedom Party will ever get such a huge majority. And this is, of course, here's the rub, certainly, because who should the party be to form a coalition with? And the only party that is possible would be ÖVP, the center-right people. And it had happened before, 2 times, and it was all a disaster. So people are not too happy to do that again. This time it also didn't work because Kickl and Nehammer, they're just arch enemies. They hate each other's guts, rightfully so. Some people had speculations that there could be a socialist Freedom Party coalition, which happened, in fact, twice, I think, in the 1980s, briefly only. So it was possible once. I don't think it's possible today, but absolutely, certainly, they will have to form a coalition.
All right, okay. And then about the AfD in Germany, and obviously anyone can chip in here. So Thin Red Line asks, many people in the rest of the West feel that the AfD might be able to change the whole discourse and politics on immigration, not just in Germany, but in the rest of the West as well. What do you think of that? Schattenmacher.
Yeah, it is certainly true that the discourse has changed. Yeah, and even in right-wing circles, it has become more open and more radical since 2015 and 16. But I don't think that the AfD is the active part in this process. I think the most important factor is just that the problems get more serious, and that encourages people to talk more openly about it. And there are more people now who are seeing it. And there is this, political force outside the parliamentary order. So people like Lichtmes or me or whatever, people who write books, who make YouTube videos. And these people are able to speak much more freely and much more clearly about these things. And I think they have an influence on this change of mind too. I think the AfD is more the benefactor of this process. They gain more votes because people get radicalized, but I don't think that the AfD is so important in radicalizing people themselves. They are too mild-mannered for this up to this point. I mean, you could maybe make the argument in the early 20th centuries that the Communist Party or that Hitler's party was the predominant factor in radicalizing people because they themselves were true radicals. But the AfD is not at this point. I mean, there may be elements in them who have genuine, deep nationalist feelings, and some don't have this. They are more liberal conservatives. But so far from the technical standpoint, how much agitation can they do? How deep does the agitation integrate people, and how radical is the position that they push? I mean, I don't see much compared to political movements in the past in terms of extremism or the level of radical thought. I think really this is coming from the problems themselves and maybe from the cultural movement that is developing around the AfD. And maybe a last thought to this. I mean, people from the Anglosphere are often used to the presidential election system, where you really can just you can bring in an outside candidate if you just vote him in to be the president. And this is obviously not the case in Germany. We have a proportional and parliamentarian democracy where you just basically vote for the party and then the party sends its leader to a coalition. And in this system, these rapid changes are not possible. But what is possible is that parties get formed and slowly gain in the vote share, and around these parties can then form a more organic culture that then has an influence on the rest of the country. So there are some upsides and downsides of the different election systems, but I think for long-term organic influence of the people, the proportional system is maybe a bit better.
I think you're right that it's not so much that the AfD is saying extremist stuff or a stronger rhetoric than in the past. It's the sense that they actually mean it, and that if in power, they would actually do what they're saying. So it seems sincere and honest and genuine. Whereas, if in Britain, the Conservatives, people have known for years that they don't actually mean it. And that's been proven recently, and it's the same everywhere. So, Niels, what would you say about this, about the AfD not being a revolutionary party, but sort of causing a kind of revolution?
I think it's important to understand that the AfD, from its beginning on, has never been a revolutionary or a fundamentally opposed party within the party system, the democratic system in Germany. The AfD originally started off as a protest movement within the Christian Democratic Party against the euro policy during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. And from there on, it first evolved into somewhat of a health only half serious party project to try and push the mother party, the Christian Democrats, into the right direction. That was originally somewhat libertarian, if something like that is conceivable, kind of social libertarian, because of this very unique German social economic way that this whole governmental and economical intertwined structure is formed. And it only from there on started to gain traction as some sort of protest movement. And people that were dissatisfied with both the Christian Democrat and the Free Democratic Party, and to a certain degree, and a little later also with the Social Democratic Party, started to leave their former parties and go into the AfD and kind of blow it up to be this balloon of protest voters and protest politicians that tried to righten the wrongs that their former parties did. But in this way, it has always been somewhat of a reform movement and a reform party, and not as much a revolutionary and a fundamentalist or what have you party. And I would say most of at least the leading politicians, with certain variations based on what state you are looking at, the leading and the older politicians, let's say from 40 years onwards, are still kind of caught in that mindset. Most of them have been either Christian Democrats or Free Democrats before. As I said, some of them also Social Democrats. And the actually more activist and more, in a positive way, fundamentalist members are those that are younger than, roughly put, 40 years. Those still have to gain traction within the party and get into more responsible positions. Sometimes they are actively hindered to gain such positions. under the presumption that they have not yet gained enough experience, both in work life and in party activities and stuff like that, but also sometimes due to mere fearfulness on behalf of the older party members and officials, that a more active and more aggressive stance might scare away potential partners for a coalition, and also kind of paint a bullseye on the party's forehead with regards to surveillance and eventual oppression by the interior intelligence services, and also a possible ban motion with the Federal Constitutional Court. Nonetheless, given the upcoming federal elections, the snap elections, and the possibility that if this motion to ban the AFD might be dismissed or might be protracted long enough to not be of any consequence for said elections, they might still be able to push hard enough, at least on the Christian Democrats, that there will be some substantial change. This is a possibility, but personally, being the renowned Black Pillar that I am, I do not really believe in that, because this would mean that they would be willing to act in a way that would kind of burn the bridges for some of the coalition options they have been hoping for ever since they have been founded in now 11, almost 12 years ago. I don't think the current leadership of the party, both on a national level as well as on most state levels, would be willing to lead such an aggressive campaign up until the national elections in late February of 2025. And so when this opportunity is gone, we will have to probably wait another 4 years. And in those 4 years, a ban motion is still a possibility that is, I dare say, more probable than a really aggressive and more or less fundamentalist AFD election campaign.
Shatem Macker.
Yeah, I would agree on many things that have been said by Niels. I would just make two comments on that. First, I mean, his comment went in the same direction. I think a democratic party, especially in a proportional system like we have it, has more than one opportunity to gain power and to influence things. And obviously the direct thing that everybody is thinking about is gaining the political power and making laws. And of course, this would be the most important step. But yeah, you can form culture and in the longer run also through, let's say, social networks and an environment that can form around you, around the party. And I think this is something that we very clearly have in Germany, and that you maybe do not have in Britain, because for a very long time you did not have a true right-wing party. I mean, we can feel that a lot of the thought, right-wing thought in Germany, is somewhat evolving around the AfD. If the AfD is too left-wing, then you make your right-wing position to push the AfD into this direction. Or if you think that the AfD is too right-wing, then you discuss it, your position with regards to the AfD. But the AfD serves as the center of debate around right-wing thought, even if you are personally not always contented with what they are doing. So that this is valuable, I think. And the second thing is, I think in the long run, some attempt from the unelected state to get the AfD banned or to neuter them will or has a high likelihood. I mean, the problem with what we see now, the AfD is now at 20%. And maybe it is not unrealistic that in 4 years' time, it would be at 30%. But still, it's a institutional foothold in universities, in the deep state, is basically 0%. So while the pressure in the election cycles gets higher, the counter pressure from the institutions gets too, and especially because the AfD, as I said, has no foothold there. And at some point, this is likely to get to a breaking point where one of the sides has to make a conclusive step in order to bring this situation into a new normal. Now, I think banning a party with 20 or 30% in the population has can have unforeseen consequences, and I don't know what happens then. But I'm also relatively, let's say, optimistic, if you want to call it this way, that something like this will happen, because otherwise I do not see deep state and university professors and the media apparatus just allowing themselves to be voted out of their offices and their salaries.
Well, this is the thing, that it would be a huge change. And all of this apparatus would have to change with it. Eugippius, who was couldn't take part in this stream, is in the live chat, and it's nice to see him there. And he said the following: the biggest lie about the AfD is that they are a radicalizing force rather than an expression of radicalization caused by the triangulation of the center-right, he said CXU.
I think I said that this in my first comment, right? I mean, that I don't regard the AfD as the radicalizing force, especially in comparison to the...
I think he was agreeing with you, but go on.
Especially comparing this to the early 20th century, where you maybe had parties as the center of radicalization. But I think I made the point there's no indication to assume that the AfD is responsible for the push in radical attitudes among the population.
Okay, and there was another super chat that related to the Germany. Post-American asked, as someone in the Anglosphere, I see a lot of people on social media speculating that the AfD will be banned. However, I recently saw a prominent German Twitter account, Eugippius, in fact, claim that this is nonsense from people who don't understand German politics and that the AfD will never be banned. Do you agree with this, Niels?
You see, first, the hurdles for an actual party ban are relatively high in German constitutional law. Ever since the Federal Republic was founded in 1949, we've had only two successful party bans. The first one was in 1952 against the Socialist Reich Party, for being a successor organization of the National Socialist Party. And the other one was in 1956 against the Communist Party. Looking at those two party bans from a, let's say, dissident perspective, and from half a century later, it seems like those two party bans were largely due to the two parties affected being the only ones that were agitating against the westward course that Chancellor Adenauer was steering at that time. And those two parties, the post-fascists, although I am not really satisfied with this term in this case, and the communists, the Western German communists, were advocating for a neutralist position with hopes, or at least pretending to hope, that this would advanced chances of an early reunification of the two German states, the being the Federal Republic and the Democratic Republic, the Eastern German Republic. Well, they both got banned in the 50s, and the Federal Republic aligned with the Western Bloc, joined NATO, and we all know the story. After that, party bans against right-wing parties, or at least groups that call themselves parties, because there's a terminological problem there, were enacted as organizational bans, which can simply be called for by the interior minister of a given state of the Federal Republic and are then just declared, and you don't have to actually put a motion to the Federal Constitutional Court for that. I believe it during the, especially the 80s and early 90s, it must have been about 30 to 40 organizations that often called themselves parties that were banned under this prerogative. Then, as I said right at the beginning, in the early 2000s, there was the first attempt to ban the National Democratic Party, which originally started off as a rather national conservative, very bourgeois party in a way, and kind of radicalized itself one time during the 70s, then almost split up, and then somewhat radicalized itself again by swallowing up a lot of free radical elements, skinheads and activist groups that were that got very active shortly after reunification in the early 90s. And after a bomb that was planted at, I believe, a bus station and detonated to hurt a group of Jewish school children that was originally blamed on neo-Nazi attackers, and then Chancellor Schröder calling out for the righteous ones to take a stand. This motion to ban the NPD, the National Democratic Party, was put in motion as kind of scapegoating them for this so-called wave of anti-Semitic and anti-and racist terror attacks. A few years later, it was found that this bomb had actually been planted by Islamists to get rid of those Jewish schoolchildren. But nonetheless, this whole anti-neo-Nazi and anti-right-wing wave had been set in motion already. And during this first attempt to ban the National Democratic Party, as I said right at the beginning, it was found that many, if not most, of the leading official positions within this party were actually manned and looked after by people who were paid informants for the German domestic intelligence service. Because of this, the Federal Constitutional Court dismissed the whole motion and declared the National Democratic Party to be not sufficiently separate from the state itself to be considered for a party ban, because then the official state organs would have to somewhat question themselves. And because due to all those informants being working inside the party, it was not the court was not able to determine whether any probable criminal action or agitation that could be used as an argument against the party was not actually commissioned by the state to some degree.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's Germany. few things happen, but it's the same in most Western European countries, especially in those that were involved with the Axis during World War II. The Italians could tell you some stories, some very interesting stories themselves. There are very few macabre events during at least the 70s and 80s that were going on without some intelligence services involved, and more or less all Western European intelligence services are kind of proxy services of American intelligence services. But anyway, they tried to ban the NPD again, like I believe it's now been 12 years ago or so. And they decided that they could and probably would have to ban the party due to its aims, because it's by now it's not about actual actions that have been taken and agitation that has been made public, but it's about recognizable aims of a organization or a party that determine whether or not it can be declared unconstitutional. And they ruled that the NPD was obviously unconstitutional due to its agenda and due to its aims and the expressed viewpoints of many of its officials, but they would not ban it because it was and would not in a foreseeable future be able to realize any of those aims. But they used this declaration and this court ruling to state that any organization that professes a biological definition of the people, of the German people, and of any people, any given people at all, would be unconstitutional in Germany. So if you express the notion that there is a biologically determined German people, you express an unconstitutional opinion. And if you write that in the agenda of a given party or organization, this organization is doomed to be banned because it professes an unconstitutional standpoint. This is more or less has been a very carefully crafted direct blow against any and all opposition towards immigration and to protect the ethno-cultural continuation of the German people. But that's what our federal constitutional court does. And that's more or less the last institution of the Federal Republic that the citizens do have a more or less large trust in, as polls prove. So they have not grasped this yet, but I hope the awakening will go as far that they finally accept that this court, as any other, is just a political one, or can be a political one if need be. With regards to a possible AfD ban, it is hard to say whether the AfD is more useful to the system as it is as an existing party where the actual opposition kind of revolves around, and so that every one of the true Democrats knows where the enemy is, to put it bluntly, or whether they can become too dangerous with regards to election results, but also with regards to the culture that Schattenmacher talked about that has been blossoming somewhat around this party. And yeah, if a motion to ban the AfD is set in motion, it will probably be because of some external players and external events that will be by sympathizers or things that AfD members do within other contexts of other organizations and stuff. In this realm of individuals and organizations around the party that will eventually be used against the party. And we have already seen some some press releases hinting at stuff like that to make the party officials' gears grind and have them denounce some of those individuals and organizations that exist around the party. Often this is successful, sadly to say, but we will eventually see what all this is about, because the snap elections are coming right up. It's I believe 8 weeks from now, and if they plan to do anything, they don't have much time left, because trying to ban the AFD after the elections, whatever the results may be, might be more successful, but it will not have the same disciplining function, I believe, that at least beginning the often years-long process of putting this ban in motion would have before the elections, and trying to scare away as many voters as they can.
The chance that the AFD gets banned before we have an election, or the snap election, in 2 months is zero. First, the next coalition in the German state is basically already determined. It's going to be the CDU and the Greens, or the CDU and the SPD, so there is no danger from that. And there is no big event that would now legitimate such an action. I mean, what I think, as I said, I think the attempt to ban the AFD in some form is not unrealistic, because the unelected parts of the government will not let this danger to their own power just walk through the parliament and declare the laws that makes their work and their salaries impossible. I don't think that this will happen. And I also don't think that the AFD is pure kayfabe. I mean, it's true, it's not a radical party or a revolutionary party as it could be, but it is also not pure show. There is something real around it and within it. So I think they are generally afraid. But if I would be now the enemy agent planning to ban the AFD, I would not go for the whole party. I would wait until something like Anders Behring Breivik happens. Of course, this is not a very common occurrence, a terror act of this size. But if something like this would happen, I would use the legitimizing moment, and then I would try to ban the most radical state subgroups of the party. I mean, Germany is organized into 16 states, and usually the eastern groups, so the former GDR, have more radical and more successful AFD branches. And I would try to divide and conquer the party along these lines with a legitimizing moment from a terror attack or something along these lines. And I'm not sure if the party would survive this as well as we would hope. Maybe in some form, probably it would survive, but I think from these, the party and the elements within it that still want to play by the rules are uniquely open and vulnerable to this form of attack.
All right. Another question is, will the AFD bring Germany into conflict with the EU? And I know that at least some of the AFD figures have said that they would take Germany out of the EU. Would any of you like to comment on that?
I would just like for a short moment just to slide in into this whole debate, because I think...
Please do. Please.
Because we are all from the... We're all German natives, so we all know what we talk about, but I think much of you, of the viewers from you, have no idea about the whole leadership about the AFD. So, as I mentioned earlier, the AFD is an important player in shifting the metapolitical cause. So, it's like the first time with the AFD, the first time there we have the opportunity that you can speak out critique of migration and the EU and so on in public, and all right-wing talking points gather around the AFD. But you should not be fooled, like thinking the AFD is like a super-based party, because all right-wing elements, even all libertarian elements, have always been banned from Germany. The AFD is like the refugium for all that are that are hated by the system. And so, yes, the AfD, I still would say it's genuinely a right-wing party, but just in the eastern part of the country, like in Thüringen with Höcke, in Brandenburg with Christoph Berndt, who's leading the party there, and in Sachsen. Sachsen always is the most far-right part of Germany. And there, well, the AfD in Sachsen is not very competent. And really, you could just put up a sack of rice at the election day and the people would still vote for it with 35% because they just think it's the AfD, it's against foreigners and it's against the state based. I like that. But to drop some red pills about the AfD, I mean, when you just look at Alice Weidel, she's leading the party. I mean, officially, you have the double peak with Alice Weidel and Tino Chrupalla. But Tino Chrupalla proved himself many, many times, really hundreds of times in the last few years, to be a complete incompetent idiot. Yeah, I have to use this harsh words, but really, absolutely incompetent in anything that you should bring with you when you want to lead a party. And well, Alice Weidel is in a relationship with, I think, a Sri Lanki or an Indian woman, and she even adopted her children. And, you know, when you look at the west parts of the AfD, well, I can tell you there are so many strange people in there. There are so many gay people in there, really gay people, and as well so many libertarian people who just I just don't like this radical Islam and so on. So just for your audience and just to the people who listen here, yes, the AfD is a change, is a turning point within the German Republic after the war, because and all right-wing elements gather around this party and we try to have an influx on this party and what it's doing. But don't be fooled like into thinking like the AfD is like a based party that wants, I don't know, establish a state like Orban did in Hungary, or that wants to establish like an ethnostate. If we look at it as it is, the AfD is like a mixed up party out of Islam critics, libertarians, nationals, and conservatives and identitarians. And I think that will, and as well the enemy, the system, will use this constitution as the breaking point for the party, because there are, this whole party is built out of so many groups, and as well as the electorate, the people who vote for it, is made out of so various groups that it's pretty easy to put them apart if there comes up the question who has now power, who gets the money. Yeah. So I think now I will give the word to Niels back, but just to make sure the audience gets this, the AfD is really not the totally based ethnostate party whatsoever, what you think about it. It's a good step, it's a step in the right direction, but it won't save our continent as we would like it to have as right wingers.
I'll bring in Lichtmes here.
Oh, Lichtmes, yes.
Yeah. Lichtmes, is the AfD based?
Don't taste and cringe.
You're just asking me because I haven't said anything in a long time. So,
well, I could have asked anyone, but I chose you for that reason, yeah.
Well, based is a sort of silly word. I mean, it's as much as Stefan said, but it's just a thing that was necessary. It was absolutely missing. And the history of AfD goes back way before migrant crisis, when this some might remember it, this famous book was released by Thilo Sarrazin. He was a social democrat from the system and was called Germany Abolishes Itself, or so Deutschland Schafft Sich Ab, and it had a catalogue of all these problems that Germany is facing, and among them were also demographic concerns and immigration concerns, and no party was covering it. So there was a vacuum there, and it was already in the air. Somebody had to go there and grab it. So I wouldn't complain too much that it isn't based enough. I'm glad it's there at all, you see, and it has been for the German broader right-wing spectrum, it has been an absolute game-changer. So it's very important that it's there, and I think no party completely can be based, because it's made up of many, or based, whatever it means, it's made up of many individuals, and Stefan also pointed out there's a difference between East and West and the attitudes of the people there. But also he said also something important, that it is the only opposition party in existence. If you are opposed to German policies for whatever reasons, and you may be for different reasons, there seems to be no other way than to pick AfD. And some are reluctant to do it because they are squirmish and they are, you know, afraid to cross the border and go there. So some of them remain at the edges, and then you have these tiny kack projects like, what's it called, Werte Union. So you have some of those CDU people who want to go back to the 80s and be as allegedly conservative as they were back then. They don't just dare to make a step. I think everybody who's not happy with current policies should support AfD, otherwise not credible, otherwise not based in whatever sense. You're not serious. You're not serious in wanting to have a change. If you complain and complain like some of our liberal conservatives and some other people do, and they always say, oh, but not with AfD, or not AfD with Höcke or so, this is just so stupid and cowardly. Yeah. So there's nothing else there. But I think what is there is pretty good compared to what was there 10 or 15 or even 20 years ago. I don't know how far you can go back, but I remember when I started publishing in this right-wingosphere was 2005. It's almost 20 years now. So I'm a real old man now by now. There was nothing. There was basically nothing. Then came Sarrazin. He was like the harbinger of light. He would say, look, there is something missing. And Sarrazin, of course, he would be too cowardly to join the bandwagon himself. But now it's there. And this is the most important thing, that you do have an opposition. And it's not in every part of Germany as strong as it should be, but it still is there. And it also forces the system to show what they are really about. I mean, you had, for example, this pseudo-left-wing opposition coming from Sarah Wagenknecht. She was splitting from the leftist party. And I think even Jared Taylor made a video or so about her, how based she is, allegedly. I mean, she does have some rational or sensitive points about immigration and other stuff. But most of all, she's just a distraction. She just showed the party, they just showed that when really chickens come home to roost, they will side with the system against AfD. There were some illusions that there could be some kind of left-wing, right-wing opposition front to damage the system, but they're not going there. It's just a distraction. So AfD is the only thing that's left, and I think that matters much more than to pure despair or disgust how based it actually is. And you cannot even answer this question simply, yeah, because it's complicated. So that's what I would say about that.
Okay, Schattenmacher.
Yeah,
I think the question of baseness is poisoned by its relativity, because if you compare our general political environment, it's just 10,000 times much less energy than in the early 20th century. So everything is probably less based than even if you would compare it to the communists. It's a very hard left-wing party from the early 20th century. They were more based in their means and their convictions than the AfD. But compared to the parties and the party environment in every big Western country, France, Great Britain, United States. I think compared to that, the AfD doesn't fare too badly. I think if I could choose any party from these big states that should represent me, if I had to choose, I would still, rather the AfD would still be my pick. I think among them, it's the most stable right-wing party so far.
All right. Niels Wegner. Sorry, who?
Sorry to interrupt. Can I add something to that, something brief, which is a sort of pet theme of mine? But, I mean, I think also AfD is, to my knowledge, the one European major right-wing party which isn't entirely under Zionist pressure or under Zionist influence. I mean, it is there, of course, and there are those people who look more to the East, some look more to the West, to the US, and some people support more Israel, others do less. But, you know, if you look at Orban, the most successful one in Europe, he has completely the Zionist backing. AfD isn't there yet, and I know people who try to influence AfD saying this is the way to success. You gotta go there. You gotta align with these based Zionists. Because in terms of baseness, probably the government of Israel is in the Western world the most right wing that there is. Okay. But they probably don't share our interests. That's the problem about it. I mean, there's has always been a problem of having a sort of international of right wingers, because sometimes the more right wing you are, the more opposed you would be, because you have nationalist viewpoints. So I just wanted to add this. I don't want to go too deep into that, but it's just an observation I do, that everybody else seems to be on this NATO pro-Atlantic line completely, like Meloni or Le Pen or so. And in AfD, it's still not yet decided, so to speak, you see. I don't know if the other Germans will agree with me here, but it's just my impression.
Niels?
Speaking to the question whether the AfD was based or not, I would say that as a party, that is, as an abstract organization, it is not, but it has managed to gather quite a based following, both regarding voters, but even more important, regarding members. Right now, it is kind of at a crossroads when it comes to the most based members and sympathizers that are gathered within its half official youth organization, the Young Alternative, which is not its official youth organization, which in Germany, as seen with the other parties, usually means that you join such a youth organization, such as the Young Socialists, which would be the youth organization of the Social Democratic Party, at, let's say, 16 years old. And then you would stay a member of that organization until you are, I believe, the usual age is 35. And from that age on, you would automatically become a member of the senior party, if you will. But it would basically mean you are a member of the senior party all along, just that it does not carry that name. With the AfD, it's a bit different, because on paper, the youth organization is a separate organization. It is kind of a what's the American term again? A 501c3 that is kind of put in front of the party, where the young people gather, and you do not immediately and automatically become a member of AfD when you become a member of the Young Alternative. And right now, I believe, because of the upcoming elections, I don't see this whole thing through, actually. They are trying to cancel this special status of the youth organization and merge it into the senior party as a youth organization, as all the other democratic parties do have. I believe this is an attempt to somewhat lessen the perceived danger of this youth organization becoming a liability for the senior party with regards to the threatened ban motion against the party. But I believe that this could, well, not actually, not to say scare off, but frustrate and thus drive away some of the more activist and more radical, in the best sense of the word, elements that the party has to offer, and the most based elements, to get back to the original question. So Alice Weidel herself just recently stated, if I can believe the news, that to her, the AfD is not and has never been a right-wing party, but a libertarian conservative party, if something like that is even possible. So this does not promise too much from the older members of the senior party and from the leadership, the leadership up until now of the senior party. And I believe hope lies within the younger ranks, and they best not drive them away foolishly just to please some intelligence services or the Christian Democrats. This will decide whether or not they still are or even are first going to be based within the next 2 to 4 years.
All right. That's an interesting idea, that the youth are, well, if we use the word based, I use that word humorously because I do think it's quite funny. But yeah, the idea that the youth are more based, because of course, yeah, the young tend to be more radical. They tend to be less, more ballsy, more testosterone. But at the same time, the cliche is that the young are more liberal and left wing than the old. So it's an interesting thing that's happening here, where the guts, that energy of the youth is actually driving them to be more radical than in a right wing direction than the older generations. Would any of you want to comment on that?
Well, I just can say that I cannot confirm it personally, but Benedikt Kaiser has written on Twitter that he has the impression that there are some parts of the Zoomers that like AfD precisely because they fall for this demonic image presented in the media. And it's certainly, we who are insiders, far from the truth. So the demonic image would represent a far more based AfD, and they think this is the party to go to. Maybe some because provocation or trolls. I mean, I also wouldn't want AfD to go into a stupid based party, which if you get what I mean. But there seems to be a sort of appeal to people who are looking for something that really is that kind of demon, you know, that the media wants. And it's of course typical for youth, for young people. They want something where there is more action. They don't want something that is just too temperate or too moderate or too boring. So
yeah. Of course. Stefan, to what extent is Switzerland safe from the dangers that face Germany and Austria in terms of mass immigration? I mean, is this debate, that what we're talking about here with the AfD and with the FPO, is that relevant in Switzerland at all?
Yeah, well, actually, I would argue the biggest threat from immigration to Switzerland really comes from Germany. No joke. Because, no, I'm serious, because so many all these Germans who are fleeing their homeland from the policies that are ruling there, they're coming to us and they start this horrible nightmare in our country all again. You know, there are studies about Swiss colonialism, and you know, it actually were like six rich guys who owned some slave ships or anything. Yeah, and you know, the professor who teaches about it, who teaches about that, is a German guy. And all this white guilt that's crippling into Switzerland, it's actually all from German professors and so on.
You got a GQ, a German question there, huh? German subverting really? The Swiss, yeah.
Yeah, seriously, it's a big problem because, you know, always when I go to Germany or Austria, and I mean, that's the sphere I've been, that's where my main political attempt has happened in my life. I went to so many demonstrations and actions, and I did so much stuff for the German right wing, and I really love the German people and the Austrians when they're in Germany and Austria, but it always becomes a problem when they just come to us. It's really, I know this, it sounds to all other white countries like a totally autistic thing, but it really is true that the Germans and the French, they just worsen Switzerland in the political landscape.
There's so many jokes you can draw from that. I mean, you just offered us a basket full of potential jokes here. I'm really grateful for that. Yeah, I'm not starting them now, but it's just fantastic what you said.
I mean, you can go for it anytime. But of course, I mean, as I said before, to us in Switzerland, because Switzerland is like to 2/3 exists out of Swiss Germans. So to us, it's always very important what's happening in Germany. When something in Germany, a major political event is happening, it always inflicts us in some way. And the same goes for the European Union. I don't know what I should say well, more. All the time, something happens there. It always inflicts us in some way. Yeah.
Yeah. Just in terms of liberal professors in Germany, Lichtmess, that reminded me of that story you told me about one of your professors at university. I don't know if you would want to tell that story.
I don't think it's relevant. I mean, it was in Berlin. It was a film school in Berlin, so probably it's just the Berlin thing. Okay. I'm not sure if you want to go there, but I don't want to guide your moderation here. But
no, I was going to go in that direction, so it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it would be good if you could tell that story because it's so. From the Anglosphere point of view, it's such an extreme thing that he said. Now, I can't imagine a British university lecturer saying that.
Yeah, there are several stories. I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but I think...
But the one about as long as there are... The German people will always be...
Okay, right. So I had this... at film school, I had this teacher... I don't know the English word, not Studienleiter. He was the
lecturer, yeah.
Yeah, so, but he was the chief of the lecturers, so to speak. And he had a very strongly developed German guilt complex. And this was about, 20 years ago. Uh-huh. I mentioned I'm that old. And it was at the time when the downfall was released. And there was a big... PR ballyhoo about it, and he had seen a preview of that film. You remember the film was advertised as this time we are going to show Hitler how he really was, without these exaggerations from other films. And so he went to see this film in the preview, and we had that film school. We had this where we would eat lunch and all that. What's it called? Cafeteria. So I sit there with another teacher, and he passes by and he says, outrage, you know, I just saw the downfall. It was even funnier because he said, ich habe gerade den Untertan, ich meine den Untergang gesehen. So he confused it with another different film called the Untertan, which means it's a satire on Prussian, subservience in before World War I. So he was just stumbling about this word, and we asked him, so how did you like it? And he says, it's outrageous. There are quotes from Hitler in it. And I thought, from Mein Kampf in it. And I thought, okay, it's a film about Hitler. So it would be natural that there would be quotes from Mein Kampf in it or whatever. And so I said to him, so you didn't like it? And he says, he takes a deep breath. And then he goes on to say, Germans have always been Nazis, and they always will be Nazis. And this is the reason why films are like these are being made in Germany. See, he thought it was a completely pro-Nazi film, and he was outraged about it. And actually, I'm pretty proud about my response. I mean, I was already in these kind of things. So I said, well, you know, back then we had National Socialists, and now we have National Masochists. And he was quite irritated by
what? He was right, though. Sorry. He was right, though, right? Wasn't he? I mean, the downfall is a right-wing meme by now. I mean, there is in this film, even though it is not pro-Nazi, it depicts the last days of the National Socialist regime. It is still full of the, let's say, energy of old. And this comes through the acting of Bruno Ganz as Hitler, and also the other stuff. And even if it contains a lot of progressive ideas or depictions, it still has a guttural right-wing energy. And this is the reason why basically just the right wing now makes memes out of this movie, and the left wing has no contact to it. So I think he was very right.
Well, I have a... Okay, this is sort of my specialist's field here we're talking about. I have a bit of a different theory about that. I wouldn't say that this film is full of right-wing energy. And when I see the memes of it, it's mostly you have the scene about the advance of Steiner's army, and then you have the different subtitles. So it's more like... I perceive it's more like making fun of Hitler or making fun of this particular scene, even though people haven't seen it. But what happened here is the following. I have a theory why he was so hysterical about that film, and rightfully so. And it's a bit different than your take, but it goes into this direction. So I remember that he said another thing which was important. He said, this is a film without... Haltung. I don't know, can anybody help me translate this in
ideological English? Conviction. The progressive ideological conviction.
Stance.
Yeah, stance. I mean, it would be more neutral. It would this word Haltung, it's of course charged with, it always has to be a sort of leftist Haltung you have toward the things. And some were repeating a critique that was being made decades ago, of a documentary made by Joachim Fest. He was a conservative, and he made a film called Hitler, a Career, and it was a documentary film, and it's pretty factual. I mean, I don't think it's a big deal, but some people back then were outraged about it because they felt it wasn't morally judging Hitler too much. It wasn't pedagogical enough, you know. It wasn't teaching people too much. It was too much. There was too much history in it, and this was before there was the release in Germany of the Holocaust TV series, which was heavily discussed in Germany. Lots of critique were there from all kinds of corners, and this, I think, is when the whole thing about the obsessing about the Nazi past really entered the new stage. And this was a film, this series had a lot of, let's say, moral stance or moral Haltung, right? And what was irritating so much to my teacher is or let's say those critics that said the film doesn't take a stance, they were mostly right, because the film had the ambition, we are telling you how it was based on eyewitness accounts, especially the secretary, Tal Junge, and she appears in the end of the film herself and says some blah, blah. Of course, from an aesthetic point of view, I would always say that no film ever does that. No film tells you how it really was. It will always be a fiction. It will also be a framing. It will be a reenactment. But the very thing is that you just try to tell a story and you do not put so much moral in it, or let alone, God beware, say that Hitler was a human being, right? This was both praised and criticized in Bruno Ganz's performance, that he made Hitler look human. he got married in the end to Eva Braun, and he had his hand shaking by what's it called, this disease. Well, his hands were shaking. He put on glasses. So, yeah, Parkinson and so, yeah. And I thought when I saw the film, I wasn't so happy about it. I felt it was a bit shallow. There were uneven performances. So some characters and actors, they really were convincing like people from the 1940s, and some were not. So overall, it was an uneven but interesting thing, but it created a lot of fear in the politically correct, because it went away from the stance, from the Haltung, which it definitely did. And this is something that had obsessed me back then, and it still does to some extent, that that you can break this chain of moralizing and of stance, of doctrine-like presentation of history by telling a story step by step with all its complexities the way it might have been. You know, you will never have a story the way it was. It's impossible. This is what I would say. But you would get away from the moralizing. And this is more what I see at work in this film, Downfall, much more than, as Schattenmacher said, a right-wing energy or so. I didn't see it that much. But, for example, you have characters like, if I remember correctly, there was an SS doctor. He's wearing an SS uniform, but he's a doctor. And he's essentially a positive character in the film. So you could see there's a guy wearing an SS uniform, and he's not a bad guy. So things are not that black and white. Things are gray. Things are different. And I found it fascinating how the political correct were scared by that, if things were not presented as black and white. They got hysterical about it, you see? Yeah. And I should mention maybe another story about my teacher, the same teacher, to just show you what kind of a character he was. I remember it must have also been early 2000s, and there was a major victory in Denmark about conservatives in Denmark. Oh, what the hell? I don't know much about Denmark. And he said, you know, we were having a discussion, and he would sit on the table, and he was almost trembling and said, yes, and now the conservatives, they have won in Denmark. And I say, okay, why does it bother you so much? And he said, because I don't want to end up in a concentration camp. That's why. And I swear this story is true. I swear it is true.
Because he's a liberal.
Yeah, I had no idea. I asked him. I said, "Why do you think the Danish conservatives would want to put you into a concentration camp? There are not yet any, but it was his idea that anything right wing would lead to concentration camps, and people like him who are liberals, super liberals, they would be in danger." So he was basically hysterical about these kind of things, you see? And yeah, that was about 20 years ago. I mean, I have told you these stories about him several times. And
of course,
but you haven't. They left a mark in my mind because they were so so over the top, and at the same time, they were so telling about certain kind of people who are, you know, in the art and in the movies and in this cultural business and so on.
Yeah, but the other thing that made that story so interesting was that you said he was of a certain age, and he was actually, he seemed quite just normal, mainstream, liberal, not far left. And yet when it came to this stuff, he went hysterical.
Yes, he wasn't a radical lefty or anything, not at all, right? But this was a sore spot, seemed inside him. And I have seen this, this sore spot appear several times. I mean, it was much stronger, let's say 20 years ago, when people were more personally in a family history involved in the past. And I mean, as another example, that there was one time I was planning to do a documentary on Sudeten Germans. And this was the time when this kind of stuff you wouldn't hear about Germany or see about Germany in the movies had a sort of, was in fashion. So there were movies being made about Dresden and about East Prussia and so, and they were all very bad, but at least you had movies about it. For the first time, this was the side of World War II you didn't know about, and they were making movies. I think it was around in the wake of Downfall. I think it also gave us some trend in the movies that you would show other aspects of the war you didn't know. And I remember I had this project to do a documentary about Sudeten Germans, and I presented it to some TV producers, and I know it was hopeless. You know, I just started quoting Ernst Jünger and Sieberberg just to fuck with them, even if they had, I'm not sure if they had known these names, but I knew I had no chance that they would buy my project. And when I left this presentation room, there was this one woman chasing after me, and she said, "Please don't have any hopes, because I'm just from the soap opera at RTL, but I have a question." And she says, "Can you explain to me what this is all about?" And it came that her mother, she was a refugee from Sudeten German. It's just a word to use the Germans from Bohemia and Moravia. She was a refugee. As a kid, she would hear lots of refugee stories. Then she would sort of, you know, shut down and didn't want to listen to it anymore. And she realized that it put her into conflict with the official narrative. Because in the narrative of her mother, there were German victims. And there were atrocities committed against Germans. And this didn't fit the picture. So she wanted me to explain to her what happened to the Sudeten Germans and why. And it was like she was desperate about somebody explaining this to her. And so I sit down, and I had done a lot of research, and I explained it to her, and I was sort of puzzled, because she had a person in her own family, her mother in her own family, and I think she felt guilty that she hadn't listened to her mother enough, and there was a change of mind going on inside her. And during that time, when I did a lot of research about this other side of World War II, it was new to me as well. It's something I found fascinating to discover. It later turned out into the first book I wrote, which was called Occupied Territory. It was about World War II in the movies, especially the German movies. It was a result from all that. And back then when I did my research, I realized that I had many of these moments where I would just randomly talk to people. And I wasn't, at that time, I wasn't much involved in right-wing circles. I mean, I was already right-wing, but my natural social circle wasn't. And I realized I often stumbled upon people that had lots of emotions about these things. And the emotions were not clarified. They were confused about them. They were confused about the history. There was drama in the family because of it. And I thought this was fascinating. I thought there was something going on in the German soul that needed to be cured of sorts. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Well, to bring it to the question that I was going to ask, that this was put by somebody a few days ago, and I wasn't sure whether to ask this, but I think it should be okay. So this one is for all of you. And Lichtmess, I showed it to Lichtmess beforehand, so he's aware of it already, and he was sort of touching on it there. Here's the question. Because of figures like Academic Agent, Pete Canones, Martyr Maid, that's Daryl Cooper, Candace Owens, and others, many people now are questioning the post-war consensus, the Nuremberg regime and what's called the Boomer Truth regime, etc. There is a mass awakening happening just now about the demonization of Germans. Are Germans aware of this, and how do you think they'll react as it grows, as this awakening grows? So, Niels, I'll take you first on that, if you don't mind.
Well, except from people that are already in tune with what is happening in the, let's say, global dissident right or whatever you want to call it, I'd say probably not, because from what I perceive and from what I can tell, most people are more or less numb regarding this matter nowadays in Germany or in the German-speaking world. Of course, they don't like being pushed around too much by Jewish organizations or by the immigration lobby or by anyone who might use the Nazi accusation as a tool to exert political leverage. But some sort of awakening or a great mental and motivational revolution is something that I don't really see happening. Of course, there are things like this debate, Tucker Carlson, or this interview. Interview is probably the better word, that Tucker Carlson has had with Daryl Cooper, that created huge waves within the Anglosphere. But that's nothing that too many people in the Krautosphere, if you want to have it that way, perceived or were able to compute, I believe. As I said, except for young people that are already looking into the English-speaking channels that we have, and we're probably enthusiastic about this, but that does not really factor into the bigger picture, I believe. Most people, most German and German-speaking people, just don't really care anymore. I mean, they kind of they are kind of brought up with this whole attitude that you can't really criticize anything Israel does, and you can't criticize anything the officials of certain Jewish pressure groups in Germany or in the Western world or all over the globe say and do. And obviously you must be very careful criticizing immigration or the immigration lobby organizations and handling foreigners, because there's always this looming threat of being called out for being a traditional German racist and Nazi and stuff like that. But it kind of has lost its edge to a certain degree, and that obviously comes in favor of right-wing organizations and dissident media, but it does not really have any revolutionary or fundamentally game-changing potential, I believe.
Okay. Schattenmacher, would you like to say anything about this?
Yes, I think this is a multifaceted problem. First, Germany has a long history of small right-wing parties like the NPD trying to revise the past, or trying to use the, different historical perspectives to the happenings of the Second World War to gain political power, and it never worked. It never worked. I mean, they were often not very smart about it, too radical, or their claims too outlandish, or whatever it was, but it didn't work. And so there is a great political fatigue, I'd say, within Germany to discuss matters of the Second World War to gain political power now 80 years later, because it has such a history of failed attempts. Now, this is different in the Anglo world, I guess, because it was not such a prominent theme through all the decades, and also because the situation concerning the law is different there, because I mean, in America you can not do what you want, as far as I understand, because you can still get into trouble with libel trials or something like this. But this is not such. It's not prohibited to discuss the matter around the Second World War in a more critical, from a more critical viewpoint. So this is the first. And the second, yeah, seeing Hitler in a, or seeing the National Socialist regime and Germany and all of history maybe from a different point of view, I think this is, of course, to some degree positive, because yes, Hitler and the National Socialist Germany and the fascists were an attempt to roll back the long progressive march that was started by the French Revolution, probably already, yeah, and a failed attempt. But if people want to see history from this bigger picture and then include Hitler not just as the big evil man, but as a carrier of history and a proponent of a right-wing worldview that tried to do something against this general shift, that's fine. But also then I see the tendency with some of let's say more low-brow creator to make out of the fascist movement and the National Socialist movement something that it wasn't. I mean, then they depict Hitler as a baby and then call him the big bringer of peace and national understanding, which I think is ridiculous, because he wasn't. His ideas were strongly influenced from Prussian militarism, from romantic 19th century thinking, from Nietzsche's philosophy of the will. And these are not just completely peaceful ideologies. These are virile, manly ideologies, ideologies that contain the idea of conquering and of carving your place in the world by violent means as something positive. I don't think it is a good idea to, let's say, rediscuss the past if the goal is to make Hitler just another progressive. Yeah. If you want to have a new perspective on the past, then you should try to understand what ideology drove those people and what particular circumstances pressured them into the action that they then took. That would be my advice to them, but otherwise I would agree with Niels that this different perspective on German history is not very noticeable within the country outside of right-wing interest groups.
Right, okay. Lichtmes.
Yeah, I agree with both of them. I mentioned that there was a time when I was sort of obsessed by this kind of thing. When I started being active in the right-wing scene in Germany, the historical revisionism, and I'm talking about soft revisionism, I'm not talking about wooden doors talk and stuff like that, but I'm talking about things like, can we have a bit more, less black and white picture? Can we talk about German victims? Can we talk about, I don't know, Stauffenberg and his people and so on. It was a huge thing within this German new right conservative scene. Of course, because there was an audience to it much more than now, because there were still people who had more personal contact to it. Either they were old people or they were the sons and daughters of people who had been in the war. But there was also this idea that this could move something. There was this idea that there's a wrong historical picture of Germany. It's a guilt-tripping picture. It's a black and white picture. And if we can get this picture right, then we will get out of the German guilt trip, and then we can finally do sensible things like, stop immigration or foster our German identity and things like that. And I haven't heard this kind of talk for a long time now. Of course, there are still people interested in historical things and so on, but there's not, I don't see this political hope in it anymore, that you can create a different narrative which would, free Germans from their guilt. But I do think that this German guilt feeling becomes less, but for other reasons, for simple generational reasons. It doesn't have such a strong hold anymore because, like in my teacher from film school, because people are not that personally evolved anymore. And now when I look at some Zoomers, it's like their grandfathers had been in the war. They didn't even know them in many cases. My grandfather had been in World War One. He was fighting in the Italian Alps in 1917. So I didn't know him. And I don't have, I do have some feelings about World War One, but you know, in a different way than people had according to World War II with all this guilt tripping and so. So I think guilt tripping will become less effective, but it not because of people like Daryl Cooper or so, which will be confined to rather small circles who are more interested in historical details.
All right. Stefan, and somebody asked me to ask all of you a question, but it seemed a bit, we got very involved with political subjects, so I didn't think it was appropriate. But at this point, I think it's probably better to ask it now. How do the different parts of the Germanosphere view each other? Now, Stefan, you talked about German professors, college lecturers, and so on. But what is the view of in Swiss Germany of Germans and of Austrians? Stefan, I think he's maybe okay. I will ask Niels first, then, about the German view of Austrians.
Well, back in the day when I started getting into the new right microcosm, most of the people I met there viewed Austria as the better Germany. That was often a quote that was used. And that wasn't even during a time where the Freedom Party was part of a government. It was some years after the Christian Democrats and the Freedom Party had formed a coalition in, I believe, 2000, from 2000 to 2003, I believe. And this coalition broke because there was an internal rift inside the Freedom Party. Martin can correct me if I'm saying something stupid here. But when I got into this whole thing around 2008, 2009, there was a Christian Democratic government in Austria, and most more or less right-wing Germans, national conservatives, nationalists, identitarians weren't that big a thing yet, were usually viewing Austria as the better Germany, mainly because it was seen as a for federal German from a federal German perspective, a staunchly conservative German-speaking country where large parts of the mainstream media were walking in lockstep with the conservative government. But I'd say that all of that pretty much has changed during the past 10 to 15 years. And by now, I would say that there's, in a general sense, there's not that much of a difference between the Federal Republic of Germany and the Republic of Austria anymore. When it comes down to the respective right-wing scenes, I believe there's some envy, probably because of the position that the Freedom Party has had for many decades now, because it is way more established as part of the party political system than AfD is. But on the other hand, that is not exclusively an advantage, I would say. So it's always kind of ambiguous. All in all, I would say that there's some feeling of kinship, but not too much, and some mostly not that serious trolling going on in between these two German-speaking countries. With regards to Switzerland, as Stefan already pointed out, it's way more complicated because Switzerland is basically divided into three ethnic parts. And with regards to the German-Swiss population, I believe it's not that much of a kinship. I believe the any population that lives in Switzerland is seen of is probably seen as something quite different from its mother population, if I may use that word.
I just would like to answer now. I'm really sorry, Melendel Wolves. You just asked me the question right at the minute I had to go on the toilet. I wasn't able to respond, so I'm sorry. Yeah, but Niels already said it quite right. You know, when you look from Switzerland to Austria, it to us, I mean, not really to me, because, yeah, I know we are all Germanic people who derive from one core, but to all of Switzerland, Austria is just like a foreign country like Germany is. And really, I think Switzerland has reached a point where you can really argue about the question, the so-called Swiss question, are Swiss people are really German? And I would actually say no. Because Switzerland has split up from the other parts of Germany, from Austria and Germany itself, such a long time ago, really centuries ago, and really built up its own mentality. But we do not have a real nationalism within ourselves again. So are Swiss people even German? I'm not sure what I should answer. I would actually answer no. Swiss people are Swiss. So to us, the Austrians are the most friendly nation in our neighborhood because they're like us. They have mountains. They speak a funny dialect. They have a funny language, and they have their funny habits. So that's why we feel most close to them, I would argue. But Swiss people are really not Germanocentric. It's really kind of the opposite. As I already said, it's like you have the most cliches, and you have the most foreign anger about Germans who come to Switzerland who work here. And I'm still not very sure where this comes from. But I think this as well explains the special status that Switzerland has today, because I mean, our last war has been 180 years ago, and it was a small civil war with like 90 deaths or something, so not such a big deal. But Switzerland doesn't really feel so close to Germans. I don't know if it is throughout of our language or of our culture or of our history. But to come back to the point you asked, I'm not sure, Niels or Martin, some time ago, just when we talk about Germany and German politics, I think it's really important to understand that there has never been a people and a country that has been defeated and lost so much like Germany did after the Second World War. So, you know, when I look up Twitter and there are some accounts who make fun about Germany in these days because it's so weak and it's so stupid, well, there has never been a nation that has been totally crushed, and the whole population got genocided. Yeah, I mean, it really got genocided during the Second World War, and that has been occupied and controlled for like 60 years, and the whole population has been indoctrinated and brainwashed. So, when you consider all of these things, and you really need to count on all these things when you talk about Germany and German politics today, there has never been a country that has been defeated and crushed in such a way as Germany has been. And when we look through this perspective now on Germany in these days, I have to say, yeah, I'm still very white-pilled, because under these circumstances, that there still is a party like the AfD, that there are still so many right-wingers, that's a good thing. And how the relationship between Switzerland and Germany and Austria will turn out in future, I don't know. Maybe if within 50 years we are the United Germanic Empire once again. Yeah, could be good, but if it will come to this point, we have to figure out. I'm not sure.
There's something I would like to ask Stefan. Can you talk a bit about if there is such a thing at all like German guilt among Swiss Germans? Because you have been out of all this. You have been the good guys, except for some bank accounts, probably, during World War II.
The bank story is still not approved. I as I said before we started the stream, the whole bank story, I still think it's a CIA psyop to put on some white guilt on Swiss people. So the whole bank story, I don't know about that anything yet. No, but apart from that, there is no white guilt. There is no Germanic guilt. I think all of Switzerland had like, if I'm not mistaken, 73 or 75 volunteers during the whole Second World War for the German side in the SS.
Armin Mohler.
Not more. Yeah, Armin Mohler. No, he didn't even.
He didn't even make it. They didn't. They thought he was kind
exactly.
of suspicious.
Armin Mohler didn't even take part in combat. He was expelled from the SS before he could even go there. So that's a bad representative about for our Swiss people. But no, there is no such thing like ethnomasochism or white guilt. And yeah, that's like an hour ago or something, I already tried to explain. I think that's as well a reason why Swiss people are so liberal, because we don't have this collective guilt. But that's an interesting point right now within the political sphere of Switzerland, because the woke left, they try to bring up this whole stuff about racism and how we were colonialists and how we supported the Nazis and so on during the war in Switzerland. But they can't come up with, oh, your parents or your grandparents, they did terrible things. They can't come up with something like this. So they have to switch from 0 to 1,000% and to come up with, yeah, you're white, you're guilty because you have privilege. And that's something that so many Swiss people just don't like. And that drives them in a right-wing direction. But no, we don't have a national culture of guilt. As I mentioned, I mean, our last war has happened 180 years ago, and that was a civil war. So it's very, very difficult to construct some kind of white guilt within Switzerland. And that's the reason why we are up to this day very free from it. And it makes absolutely no sense to establish something like this within Switzerland, because everyone is just like, come on, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Can I make a short comment about that? Because I think it's interesting that you still seem to speak very, maybe not fondly, but directly about you as a person from Switzerland, as a Swiss person, and these are your people. And I can understand this, especially regarding the history and that you were not involved in all the conflicts, but I don't have this feeling about Germany at all. I mean, I met activists from Switzerland and from Austria and from Germany, right-wing people, my people here. And I think this there is very little difference in attitude and goals there. So these are all, I consider them all part of the network, no problem. But when it comes to Germany itself, I mean, I don't want to say I don't see myself as a German anymore, but it goes into this direction. Of course, I'm German by ethnicity and by broader culture, but I mean, the most cruel enemies that I have are all German, right? I mean, these are the German left-wingers and the German mainstream. Yes. They make my life most difficult, far more than any migrant would do. So I have big problems identifying with the German nation or with Germany as a whole. I have become more like a tribal thinker. Yeah, who is part of the network becomes part of the nation, so to say. And this is how my perspective is on these things. And it's very interesting for me that in Switzerland, there seems to be still some more intact view of the nation as a whole with all of its people.
Well, different kinds to respond about this. I think when you met some right-wing activists from Switzerland, then you met some right-wingers from Junge Tat. And I like these guys.
Yes,
they're awesome.
Yes.
They do an amazing job. But I know them as well. And well, there are a lot of them who have like half German, half Austrian, half Italian, half France, whatsoever. What makes them more like thinking maybe into I don't know, into a white nationalist mindset, like you said. So you think more tribal. The ones who share my ideas and who to belong to my own, we can make up one again. And but I mean, we have some other difference here, because Germany is an ethnic nation, and not just the ethnic nation in language, but the ethnic nation in blood as well. But Switzerland really is like a ethno-state, a white ethno-state, if you want to call it like this, because our state was formed out of Italian people, Germanic people, and French people. And I think maybe I'm not really representative for my own country, because the demographics shifted lots in the last decade. But yeah. The reason why I speak still about Switzerland as a nation and why I still consider it as an own nation is because I really, kind of lip-tarded way, kind of individualistic way, because I just know that there where I'm born and where I live today, that's the blood and soil where my family lives since 700 years. And I know some parents of mine, some ancestors of mine died during the Austrian invasion and the French invasion and the Italian invasion and so on. So I think Swiss people are more tribal than other nations, but Switzerland is not like an ethnic nation. It's really a nation out of will, but still a white nation. But if you look at to this day, even within the right wing, there's kind of a combat going on. Is it about blood? Is it about will? What is it that makes Switzerland Swiss? But to me, to be honest, it's really my private and my own heritage that still makes me think in this way and in this manner.
Say, how are your feelings towards your French-speaking compatriots? Do you feel very connected to them, like you are under the shelter of the same Swiss patriotism? Or what is it like?
To be honest, not at all. But
yeah, but that's interesting.
I as well do not speak French, so there is this huge language barrier. But I speak, for example, I speak Italian. So with the Ticinesi, with the people from Ticino, I can relate and I feel very comfortable with them. But with the French people, there is just this language barrier. But this is kind, when you ask this question, you know, I mean, you can call it a cope. And yeah, I guess it is a cope. But I just like to think about Switzerland as like a white ethnostate where the three best nations of Europe unite, Italy, France, and Germany. But Switzerland was united after Napoleon took all of Switzerland, just put it into one country, right? And after that, when the Swiss people on themselves founded the first time one united state, well, we had to give citizenship to everyone who was within it. And just before we formed one country, the Italians and the French-speaking people, they were not really citizens. They were just like the conquered sphere in a protectorate, in this sphere, and they had no political rights. And they just gained their voting rights, because we had to form a national state with the pressure of Napoleon and then with the pressure of modernity, and then we just gave citizenship to Italians and to the French. But still, I'm not sure, because Switzerland, I mean, when you ask me about this, do I feel really connected to French, to Swiss French? No, not really, because I don't understand them. I have nothing in common with them. I've never been there, to be honest. On one hand, but on the other hand, is Switzerland as well, again, a nation of the will, because as I heard, I can't confirm it, but as I heard, the French Swiss, they speak in the same strange manner as I heard, like the Swiss Germans speak German and the Swiss Italians speak Italian to the Italians. So I don't know, maybe it's just a nation of strangers. But still, what should I say? It worked, and it's just a success. The success of the nation just went on during the last 150 years. With pressure going on white people, I think the Swiss model will be a good one to go into the future.
One last thing. Would you say that the French are more isolationist? It sounds like there's more of a relationship between the Germans and the Italians within Switzerland.
No. Don't mistake that. The Germans and the Italians relationship is just closer for me as an individual because I speak Italian. But most German speaking Swiss people, they hate the Italian speaking Swiss people, but they hate the French speaking Swiss people. So don't get that part wrong. I just speak Italian. That's why I like the Ticinesi.
Right. Okay.
There is some kind of divide. I think within Switzerland, you see, it's not a multicultural nation, right? Because every ethnicity and every group who speaks its language, they have their own parts. And I think the model of success for Switzerland was that you gave all these small communities with their own language the power to rule themselves and to split up within their own canton and to rule themselves, and that they never had such a bullshit like it's happening in Südtirol, for example, in Italy, where the Italian government tries to push for a great replacement of white people with Italians to replace the German-speaking population there with Italians. You never had something like this in Switzerland, because you just have your territory, you stay there, you can rule yourself. And yeah, that played out to be a big success, because the only thing you have to contribute to the nation was always to defend it when it was at danger. And that was always the point when all of the Swiss people united.
Right. Interesting. Very interesting. Okay. Well, on the matter of the relationship between Germans and Austrians, Lichtmess, you have a thing about the Piefkes, don't you?
He's laughing. I think he has got a thing on the Piefkes as well. This is what unites us. Yeah, okay. I have talked several times about it, but it's more jokingly, you see. But there is certainly a difference between Austrians and Germans in general, but also within Germany you have lots of differences. I mean, I used to live for a long time in Berlin, and I got to know lots of people from the East, and they seemed like completely different people to me than people from the West. They have a different history, they have a different mindset, they talk differently. There are even speculations about the secret Austrian, East German, Ösi and Ossi connection and so on. But I mean, talking about this is rather, cute and funny and historical, but it's much less relevant than the differences between the Swiss and everybody else who speaks German, in my opinion. Right? I mean, I'm glad we have a state of our own. I wouldn't want to have an Anschluss. would be a terrible idea. I think it is good for Austria that we have become much more like Switzerland after the war. I mean, it was our only way out. And I repeatedly said, I think we did less guilt tripping than the Germans. It didn't work as much because, as I say, the Austrians are a bit like the Italians among the Germans. So we are not as gründlich. We don't need to get everything clear cut and clean. We just like to go around things and let things be. It's much more our mentality. Of course, we have also our inquisitors and our hystericals and our ethnomasochists here. But a thing like my teacher at film school, on that level, I only saw in Germany. You see, maybe that's my limited experience here. And again, within Germany, you have differences. I mean, for example, I certainly feel closer to Germans who are Catholic, Alpine, like Bavarians or so. That's just a more similarity of mentality and anything. But I don't think this is all politically very relevant, to be honest.
No, but it's interesting because after all, this hangout is going out to largely to the Anglosphere, although I know that there are at least some Germans listening to it. Somebody said that Austria is it's most similar to Bavaria. Someone said it is really just the eastern part of Bavaria. What would you say?
Come on, okay. That's a bit of an Anschluss in the other direction. There are differences between us and them, of course. I mean, you will have these cliches about people with Lederhosen and with humps of beer and the hats with the goat's beard on it and stuff like that. But tourist cliches, Alpine tourist cliches and so on. And even within Austria, we have a difference between people from Styria, Carinthia, Vienna. This is a point I have been repeatedly making against diversity, because the idea of diversity we have around is very superficial. It's very, in fact, it's very racial or racist or racialist whatsoever, but also on a very surface level, because they think that skin color is the only difference. I used to call it the Smarties dogma. The Smarties are these chocolate lenses. I know they may have a different name in the Anglosphere, but on the outside they have a nice color, and inside they're all chocolate. They're all the same. This is the idea of that. And I would repeatedly make the point that there is lots of diversity already within the German states. And it was even a question of it was difficult for Germany. This has been an issue in German literature and politics dating back to Goethe's times, that this realization that German people are not very unitable or unifiable. There's always problems with unifying them. They would always split up, and I'm okay with us being split up at this point now, because they're not all eggs in one basket, if you get what I mean. So I'm glad Austrians have a different state here. And but this is something that is often neglected, within a nation, you already have a lot of diversity going on. And as between nations, it's certainly disappearing and vanishing by the advance of modern, connected, globalist civilization. Of course, this is all diminishing everywhere or anywhere. But I still think it's something important. And it's funny what Stefan said about why Switzerland worked, and they had these different ethnicities. It's in fact the ethno-pluralist model, haha. Like everybody,
yes,
you can keep
this.
Yeah, you keep them together but apart, right? This is the classical ethno-pluralist model. Or sometimes you don't keep them together, but if you have to keep them together, you also have to keep them apart so everybody can have his own self-determination and his own culture. And of course, whenever you speak German, it isn't that much of a thing, you know. So you can go to Saxony, or you can go to Bavaria. You can realize different people are different, landscapes are different, customs are different. The way they talk, especially, is different. So language is certainly a very crucial thing. And certainly, you must have heard this old line by Oscar Wilde when he said the English and the American are only divided by their language or so, which I guess he said it to have a pun. It's funny. But some people say it about the Germans and Austrians as well. We do speak in a different, very different way often than our German brothers. And this is part of the identity. This is part of the feeling, the part of the feeling of being Austrian or being different. And also Stefan mentioned that he likes about Austrians the funny way we speak, which is certainly closer to the way I speak is probably closer to Stefan than it would be to either Niels or Schattenmacher. Yes. Yeah. Mm. So
Stefan, yeah. You wanted to say something.
No, I just wanted to agree with Lichtmess about this whole thing. But nothing to mention in special.
All right, all right. There was some super chats. Alt White said, Europeans can no longer afford tribal differences. That may have worked in centuries past when we were isolated on our own continent. But in the modern world, it's us against the rest of the world. We must unite to survive. I think that's understood. And I also think that what Stefan has been describing is probably the best way that we can do this, to use the term ethno-pluralist, where we respect each other's differences and don't attempt to merge together, but understand that we have a common goal, that we all have we all need to defend Europe, basically. So I think that Swiss model, yes, it's certainly going to be of interest, I think, to Europeans in general in the future. Okay, let me get through some other super chats that were posted. Construct said, the four guests speak better English than I do. But in my own defense... Sorry. But,
thank you very much. Whoever said that, thank you very much.
But I often see this, that Germans and even more Dutch and especially Scandinavians speak extremely good English. And it's humbling, really. But anyway, he said, yes, they speak very better English than I do. But on my own defense, I was raised in a town called Tipton, which is quite a handicap to overcome. I'm sorry about that construct. Okay, post-American said, and I think we've already addressed this. He said, for Stefan, are the Germans who migrate to Switzerland inculcating Swiss guilt about being neutral in World War II? Does that exist at all among native Swiss? The neutrality, does that cause any guilt?
Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
German college professors and so on, do they try to make Swiss people feel guilty about Switzerland's neutrality in World War II?
Yes, of course. Yeah, of course. I mean, all of the white guilt, as I mentioned before, all of the white guilt stuff comes from German professors or Jewish professors or French professors who migrated to our country to profit from our commonwealth and who live here and then start to preach blood guilt about our people, and it's total bullshit. And but these people, they play an important role in the media and as well in the government, and that's as well the reason why the Swiss government, I'm not sure this year or even last year, broke the very famous Swiss neutrality and just started to put on some sanctions on Russia based on some weird evidence, all because we don't like the war in Ukraine, so we have to sanction Russia. And basically these libtards just broke the Swiss neutrality that existed for 160 years, that we can play the good guys now in the Ukrainian war on the side of Ukraine against Russia. And that's that's one of the small things happening. As I mentioned, all the things are going wrong in Germany, France, and England. They happen in Switzerland as well, but on a lower level. And so, we give up our neutrality and start to put on sanctions on the Russians. We start to get closer with the European Union. We start to get closer with NATO. And if we look at it at the big picture, you can just say, it's the degeneracy. It's modern world. It's a century of the last man. So obviously this is what will happen when you have these people. But if you look closer at it, I'm part of the people who say, it's because of some people who come in our country and who have influx in our country and who rig it into a special direction that pleases their interests. So absolutely, Germans, most of the Germans who come to Switzerland, of course, they want to get more pay. And most of them are even right-wingers and decent and good people. But yes, the whole white guilt stuff and as well all this lip-tarded stuff, it really flourishes in Switzerland among German migrants. And French and English migrants, all the wealthy, well-educated people who come to us.
Right. Well, I just hope that the youth don't fall for it. All right.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah. Alt White also said, wonderful discussion, Woz. Thank you for hosting. Well, thank you very much. As I said earlier at the start, this is a sort of, this is the first time I'm doing this, and I'm not quite sure. I'm learning as I go. And then there was also a construct said, I have nothing to declare but my genius. That's Oscar Wilde, of course. And I believe that the extension to that is Oscar Wilde said that to the immigration official, and the official replied, so I'll just write down nothing then, which is rather off the cuff and quite witty of him. But anyway, I think that was all the super chats in there, except there was one from Mr. Roboto about crypto and Monero, which was delisted. But I suspect that none of you are crypto guys that in a position to comment on that. Okay, we'll just move on from that. Sorry, Mr. Roboto. I'll try to put it to people in the USA Hangout later on. ABC said the following. Angela Merkel destroyed all the nuclear power plants. I think the last one was shut down just a few weeks ago, if I remember correctly, in Germany. Alice Weidel wants a Germany free of nuclear weapons. What's with this adversity that German top female politicians, left-wing or right-wing, have towards anything nuclear? The neo-Marxists also have similar views. Niels, would you like to take this?
This is kind of a mixed bag, a very large mixed bag. As the story goes, Angela Merkel's individual decision to get Germany out of the use of nuclear energy was caused by a somewhat emotional reaction towards the Fukushima disaster. But the declaration, or at least the attempt to get Germany rid of nuclear weaponry by Alice Weidel or by whomever, is quite a different thing, because there are nuclear weapons stationed on German territory that are under the command of the US, and as far as I know, would be in a state of war, of NATO war against an external threat, read Russia, because China is very unlikely to invade a Eastern European or Middle European country, at least for now, would be carried by German planes against the enemy in this radical case. That is at least the theory behind that. The thing is that for a sovereign nation, it is more or less, in theory, unthinkable to have foreign weapons of mass destruction stationed on their territory that they don't have any say about. Germany is different in many ways, but on the other hand, I mean, name one NATO country that the US do not have military bases in, and probably also nuclear weapons. This is nothing too special, sadly, anymore. And any nationalist, or at least vaguely patriotic or right-wing politician that states something like that must be seen in a broader context of trying to get back more sovereignty for the German nation state. How would they try and force the Americans to ship back their atomic bombs to the US? I mean, back in the day when during Donald Trump's first term, he announced or threatened, I believe that's a matter of perspective, to withdraw U.S. troops from Germany, I guess most actual German right-wingers, I have to say, cheered that. Obviously, nothing like that happened. But I believe by now it would be more than accepted by most Germans, even the normal citizens, would the United States withdraw their troops from our country. Just a few months ago, there has been a rather blatant case where during a fair, some festival in the southwestern Germany, a an American soldier that was stationed around the city where this festival was taking place stabbed a German citizen who died on the spot and was obviously apprehended by American military police and put to trial by the U.S. military, but went off scot-free and was then flown back into the States, as far as I know. I'm not too sure about the ethnicity of this U.S. soldier, but I guess anyone can assume something about that. And this obviously enraged the local population and went even beyond the local news. But this is just a very tiny piece in this whole puzzle of the U.S. maintaining their forces in Germany and, of course, in all of Europe and all NATO states, and being sometimes not as much welcome as they would have been like some 40 years ago during the height of the Cold War. Because even though there's a war going on between Russia and Ukraine, and Ukraine is not seen but handled by many as being a member of NATO and the EU already, at least for Germans, many, if not most of them, are either actually fed up with the US military presence in Germany, or at least do not have any understanding for any given necessity for that anymore. The only people that still want those people to be around are politicians that see them as kind of their bodyguard by proxy. And of course, the mayors and businessmen in the cities that are close to those US bases because they profit from them. Besides that, I guess nobody is actually interested in the US maintaining their military presence in Germany. And if I don't really see them withdrawing, but if that were eventually to be the case, I guess most Germans would not exactly cheer them, but just, would also not cry for them if they were to leave the country.
I think I have a slightly different opinion about that, and especially regarding the nuclear question. And I think there is a deeply ingrained fear for sovereignty or about sovereignty of the German people. And nuclear technology, less so the civil application in nuclear power plants, which also has a long tradition of German protests against this from the environmental movement, but this is another topic. But even more so than the nuclear power technique technology in bombs, is connected to the idea of state sovereignty and military sovereignty and making decision on your own. And I think exactly this is what Germany and many Germans try to avoid. I mean, you could see this in Angela Merkel's approach to foreign policy, to never go alone, to always try to get the partners involved and to always reach a consensus so that Germany would not make the decision on their own. And I think this is exactly the reason why they are so afraid of getting sovereignty through nuclear technology, because then at some point you would be responsible for what you do. You may enter into a situation where you have to decide about the use of these weapons and invoke this old fear of making the whole world your enemy, because this is exactly what costed us the country in the First and Second World War. And I think this is still at present in Germany. And I also think that is the reason why there is not overwhelmingly negative attitude towards the, let's say, US occupation here. It's not well liked, this is true, but exactly for this reason, because we assume that the Americans can make decisions for us and then bear the brunt of the responsibility, we let this pass. And we let this pass even among the more moderate right-wing circles.
All right. Well, does anyone have anything to say about that before we move on? No? Okay. Well, we'll get to some more super chats then, because I don't want to neglect those. And I think that the nuclear question is very interesting, because especially after Nord Stream, it seems that how is Germany going to get its energy from now on? I mean, is it just going to deindustrialize? Is that the end of Germany as an industrial powerhouse? It seems like a massive question. And I'm amazed that these politicians were able to shut down the nuclear power plants. It just seems like such a crazy, irrational thing to do. Any of you want to pick up on that? It seems like a very big matter, like important question.
I worked for quite some time as a natural scientist, and many of the plans, not just regarding nuclear power, do not seem to work, or do not seem to work at scale and at prices that could support the German economy. But I think this is really a consequence of wishful thinking on part of the Greens. Sure, also, there is resentment against technology and industrialization among the Greens, and this is another topic. But I also think this is genuine mistakes have been made with regard to the calculation of how likely it would be to shift the entire energy structure of the country to renewable energy. People who are not very well versed with numbers and physics and engineering and all of this, I guess, thought it would be much easier to undertake such an industrial endeavor than it turned out to be. And this is one of the consequences. And there is this long tradition in Germany that you basically cannot fail. I mean, all of the decisions that we made since 1945 never affected our economic potential. I mean, there was the CDU and there was the SPD and there were 1,000 decisions, but in the end, we always had economic growth. So I think there's a deep ingrained assumption that the German Republic will always have economic growth, no matter what we do. And if this is the case, then we can try it with green energy and we still have that level of industrialization and economic potential. And it turned out that this is not true. This is just magic thinking about the strength of Germany. And we are learning a lesson now that this was a miscalculation.
It's amazing that it seems to come from a sort of German pride, a faith in, ironically enough, a faith in German ability. Anyway, okay, we'll move on to this. Eugypius. I'm never sure whether it's Eugypius or Eugypius, so sorry if I've mispronounced that. But he sent in a super chat and said, "Sorry I could not make it tonight. Great show, gentlemen." Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And the Enrieb said, "I don't have a question. While listening to this stream, I just wanted to say that these banquet streams are a fantastic idea. I feel it connects our people. We are not alone. Our language differs, but our plight, our future, and our solutions are the same." Well, thank you very much. And I think there is something in what you're saying. I mean, certainly millennial is an attempt to bring people together. And I think that includes people of different nations. And I also think it respects the different nations as well. I think that's very important. Aunt Sally said, "An English boomer here. It weighs heavy on my conscience about what has happened to Germany before, during, and since the war. I'm grateful that these guys are here to speak up and re-educate everyone now." Well, thank you very much, Aunt Sally. And then Ludek said, "Good evening, gentlemen. What are your feelings about Eastern and Northern neighbours? I'm Czech, and I'm Czech Republic, and I'm quite curious. Sadly, the history between us is not the best, and the aftermath of World War II was the cherry on top. 1918 was not a good year. By the way, huge thanks to Woz for organising the millennial." Thank you very much. Lichtmes, would you like to talk about the relationship here with the Czech Republic?
Oh, well, where to begin? I mean, I only can say it, but I mean, I could start with my personal feelings here. And I said it often that I do feel a connection to this Habsburg Empire countries, and they do reflect in my family history. When I look at the names of my family, I mean, as far as I can see, they have been German speaking for as far as I can trace it back, and it's not that long, so about 200 years or so. But I can see the surnames, and they are from Slovenia, from Hungary, from Czechia. So there's certainly a lot of influence here and a lot of common history. In many ways, the language barrier, however, is really a thing. So you might be a close neighbor, but still there's something very strange about people whose language you do not speak. So I go to Hungary and I see Budapest looks a lot like Vienna in many respects, sometimes even more beautiful, if I may say that. But the language is completely alien, really strange and alien. So language is something that does connect you on a personal level. And this is really an individual thing, because obviously we don't learn Hungarian or Czech. And usually it would be the other way around, because the German language was the dominating in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You could go to Budapest, you could go to Prague and speak German, and you would be understood. I mean, I saw this in 1990 when I was there, 14 years old, and the borders were falling down, and my parents, they took me over to Prague, and there were lots of people who were still able to speak German there. And now it's lost. Now when you are in Czechia, you speak English, which I find perverse, okay? But I understand who won the war. It's American Empire that's ruling now in one way or another in these countries. And certainly it was only years later when I got more into the Sudeten German thing. I mentioned it before. And I must say it's sometimes not such a good thing to remember history too much, because I realized inside myself there was a resentment growing against Czechia or Czech people. Not a really serious one, all right? But as soon as I was into the history and I realized how many people were expelled from Bohemia and Moravia, how many people were killed, how many cities were, you know, evacuated from Germans, or villages were destroyed, there were hundreds of villages destroyed, and so. And then I would suddenly get conscious when I take a bus from Berlin to Vienna, that goes to Saxony, Dresden, and then through Czechia to Austria. And sometimes I would pass the Sudeten German parts, and I would look out for houses that were in a bad condition, that were destroyed. And so I felt a sort of resentment coming up, because I remembered history. I mean, it didn't last very long. I don't know, history is a divisive thing. I also remember that back then when I was doing research on Sudeten Germans, and I don't want to be tiresome now by getting into too much detail, but just as a story, right? I was also interviewing a Czech artist. He came to Austria in the 1980s, fleeing from communism. So he was a dissident, so he came to Austria. And when Czechia became part of the European Union, I think early 2000s or so, there was a lot of talk about the Benesh decrees, which were responsible for expelling the Sudeten Germans out of Czechoslovakia and taking away their property and homes. And they were legally still in function, and there was really no question about getting this property back or so, or getting recompensation, but people were looking at least for some symbolic compensation or gesture or so. And this artist, he made a funny thing, that he had a bust of President Benesh, and he had it sometimes the words escape me, but he had copies of that head, hundreds and hundreds times. mold. Yeah, yeah. And he cast these hats. He made these hats of President Benesch, and he put them along the border. And it was called the border in the head because they were just heads of President Benesch, and it looked funny. It looked surrealistic. And I have a penchant for surrealism. And I asked him what it was about, and he said, "Well, the curious thing is that everybody who saw it had his own ideas. So there were some Czech people who said, 'Great, you made the Austrians angry,' and some Austrians said, 'Great, you just point out to the injustice that were the Benesch decrees.' And there were even some Benesch, some Czech nationalists who would say, 'You are dragging Benesch into the shit. You're making, you're ridiculing him.' And so everybody had a different notion about why he was doing it, right? I thought it was a good idea because there's certainly a common history, a common Austro-Hungarian history, but there are also really strong gaps filled with blood, or just the language barrier, history barrier, and so on. So in the end, it's not as nice and cozy as I personally, as a Habsburg romantic, would like it to be. I certainly liked when Kiki was meeting up with Orban, and everybody in the Austrian press got very angry about it. And I thought, this could be nice. We have a Orban-like government someday led by Kiki in Austria, and we have a sort of Austro-Hungarian alliance again. This could all be nice. But again, you know, I'm talking as a romantic here. So that would be a possible answer I can give here. I could go on telling stories, but I don't want to bore everybody, you know.
No, it's okay. It's a very interesting answer, but I'm conscious of the time because the next stream is supposed to start in about 15 minutes. All right. And then there was another, if you hold on a second. Ah, yes.
Can I make a quick comment about this question, about these Czech questions? It's just a minute.
Yes, go for it. Yeah.
Yes, because I have a different feeling about this. I mean, I have no bad feelings about Poland or Czechia, basically, whatsoever, on an emotional level. But I think these nations, everything basically between Russia and Germany, is kind of rightfully afraid to some degree about Germany and about Russia, because even if I don't harbor any negative feelings about them, if we would ever get into power, the pure dictate of power, the logic of the world dominating forces would probably cause some squeezing effect on these nations to fall in line with these bigger power blocks that surround them. I mean, there are 100 million German-speaking people and there are 150 million Russians. And between these countries, there's no power that could really resist them, and also no atomic weapons between these countries. So I think it is wise from the standpoint of these countries to be on the edge about the political developments on this world. And I think in the long run, there will be at least some attempts to unify German and Russian interests, and maybe not to the benefit of these nations. It's not that I want this. I'm just speculating about the natural logic of power here. And I think nothing can really prevent this from someday happening, or at least that there's an attempt at this by some party, maybe not even the right-wing party, but by some party to close this gap.
I know we're running out of time, but I would briefly want to comment on this as well, if I may. So,
yes, go.
Yeah, I mean, this is, of course, a different aspect and an important aspect. And again, I mean, I always tell personal stories, but I remember that I visited the 11th of November celebrations in Warsaw in Poland. And it's strange, if you come from Western Europe, you enter into an alternative universe where everybody's patriotic as fuck, I'm sorry to say, and you have masses on the streets celebrating the nation. And at first I was sort of excited, but I soon got annoyed by it. You know, it started getting on my nerves. And here's the thing about Polish patriotism, that it depends so much on feelings from the past and of fear from Russians and Germans. And from this point of view of a Russian-German alliance, which was always a benefit in German history, Poland is really a nuisance because it's just in the way and you never know what to do about them. So if you look closer into these kind of things, all these ideas about, you know, we Europeans, we have to stick together, we're in it, it becomes more and more difficult because these national sentiments, they are so ingrained, but also concrete interests. So I guess I agree that Poland should be on the guard. If I don't think a united Germany would invade Poland again and take back the eastern territories, but it would certainly mean a shift of power and balance. It would trigger a lot of, you know, Polish and Eastern European fears. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about the invasion thing, to be honest, if the German demographics would be right. I mean, we have, when we talk about this, we have to be serious. But I just interrupt the stream on this behalf because Lichtmes just said he witnessed the October 11th march some years ago, and I did it, in fact, this year. Because I have a Polish friend, and he just asked me to if I want to join him, and I was like, yeah, okay, I have a week off, nothing to lose, okay, let's go to Warsaw. And just as Martin said, it's really astonishing when you go there, you know. We stayed in an Airbnb, and you already wake up at 7 a.m., because there are Polish people all around within the city, already lighting up some pyrotechnic and just blow up something to celebrate the national holiday. So already wake up at 7 a.m. And we really took part in this march of independence from the Polish people in Warsaw. And the night before, we were at the gathering with young guys of this Young Nationalist Party of Poland, the Konfederacja. Keith Woods has been there, as well as Gunnar Lindemann. Funny, he's like a meme figure from the AfD from Berlin. And there, some Poles told me, yeah, we expect there will be, 300,000 to 500,000 people. And I already thought when some Poles told me about 100,000 people should be there to celebrate the national holiday. Yeah, come on. Never there will be 100,000 people. You're making numbers up. But actually, we marched the whole street through. And when we were finished and we went back, the whole street of Warsaw was still covered in flags and people. So I've been there this year, and actually I really think that we're on this day at least 400,000, maybe 500,000 people in the street. But the problem with this Eastern nationalism, as Lichtmes said, is like this holding on to bad times. You know, it's like German nationalism, as like English nationalism or French nationalism, it always depends on the good achievements that happened and on the things that makes us proud. And you can call it the Faustian spirit that you want to get aligned with. But with this Eastern European nationalism, you always have this resentment against the others. And so it happened as well in Warsaw, because, I mean, we were there. It was great that they were always like Polska, Polska, Polska. And in the end, there was just some band playing. And as one Pole translated to us, one of the final songs of the demonstration was the Germans will never spit in our face again. And we, I was there with six German guys, and we were there like, yeah, okay, so thank you, Polish white nationalists. Yeah, we Germans, we won't spit you in the face again. And that's, Marty really is right about this. That's a huge problem. I'm not sure how big is this issue when you look at it of Hungary, because Hungary has always been an ally to Germany, so you don't have there the anti-German stuff in it. But still, in all this based Eastern European nationalisms, when you just always look at them, they have always deep resentment, and these nations are not very functional. And as well, these nations are, yeah, because so many white nationalists from America and Canada and England and all of us in Europe, they like to look at Eastern Europe and think, oh, everywhere there is fucking based and everything is good and there are only white people. Yeah, but when you just go to Eastern Europe and when you go to these places and when you look at it, you realize, yeah, okay, maybe it's a little bit better, just ethnically speaking, but still it's not really the country I would like to live into. Yeah.
All right. I think that's understandable. There's all of this, a sense of where you belong, and every country is different and it's not your home. So, yeah, I think that's really the whole point of a lot of what we do, all of us. It's an attachment to our own country, our own culture. Unit Tactics, finally, this is just to end with, said, the false categorization of the Germanic people in recent decades has been, you are evil. The migrant influx and its consequences have shown the Germanic people a greater evil. Do they have the strength to overcome this and keep their people safe, as we all should? I think that's an open question that I want to end with, rather than, I mean, otherwise I would ask it to each of the guests, but I think time is very short now because I need to wrap up. So I think we'll leave it at that. And obviously we all hope that the answer is yes, that they will overcome this. And but then the same is true of all of us outside of the Germanosphere as well. So, okay. Well, I'll go through each of you and ask you just to say some closing words. Schattenmacher first.
Yes, I like the stream. I think it was an interesting discussion. Maybe my last words to the question that was asked here. I'm at least positive in the sense that in Germany, still all of the elite sections of society are completely German. We don't have a situation here like in the United States where you have Indian interest groups or all these interest groups. We have still ethnic control of our own nation. And I think for this reason and regarding elite theory and all of that, this country has a good chance of regaining full control about its territory. Although obviously the way to this point will be not an easy one. Yeah. Goodbye, everyone.
Okay, thank you. Niels?
All in all, I'm trying to keep it short. I believe it is necessary for Germans as a whole and probably the German-speaking peoples in general to re-understand what politics actually is, and that basically is covering the interest, first covering one's own interest, and one's own interest being the interest of one's own people. I mean, if we can talk about that hours and hours on, because especially in Germany, there's lots of definition issues going on about what even is a people, or is there even a people, or is all of this just socially constructed and stuff like that. But I guess anyone who watches this benevolently knows what I'm talking about. And once we have regained the concept of the political, to quote Carl Schmitt here, as being covering our own interests, which are preserving our own people and its future and its prosperity, then we can try and get back our own spine, our national moral spine, and look at other European nations and peoples among equals, and try and gain this if you want to put it like that, this white brotherhood or this European brotherhood that everyone's been in our circles been talking about now for decades. And I believe people around my age, that is younger than 40, I already named this as kind of a generational rift, if you want to see it in this light, are way more prone to views like that than older generations are. And I have a lot of hope, especially due to our media possibilities, as long as we still have them, for networking and getting to know each other better across national borders than the generations, especially the right-winger generations before us, were able to, and thus craft a new understanding of comradeship and of friendship even, but all under the cover of a, as I said, concrete political notion that this is not about trying to make up for the past or to gain absolution for things that have happened, but to preserve our own interests, which at this point are common European interests. And once we have succeeded in preserving those interests, then we will still have plenty of time for sorting out things that by then, maybe 100 or 150 years ago, maybe matters of 150 years ago. And up until then, I wish us a lot of luck and hope that formats like this and media opportunities like this will serve this purpose and bring us closer together.
Excellent. Thank you. Stefan.
Well, what can I say for final words? I think we talked now about the whole Germanic speaking sphere, and I think we just have to look at reality as it is, and it looks pretty bad to us. Even though I share the thoughts of hope that just Niels expressed, and Martin Schattenmacher as well. If we look at our reality, we are kind of in a harsh situation, and due to the demographic situation, there won't be any revolution happening soon. There won't be, I don't know, anything just in a very fast way changing. So I think if we understand ourselves as descendants of people who lived in Europe and in America, or who are descendants from Europe from thousands of years, we should as well plan from this perspective to the future. And it's when we think about, we have to red pill people, and we need to gain more people to our movement, I would say no, we should form societies in real life. We should connect in real life. We should form communities. And yeah, I mean, in the end, to all right-wingers among the globe who listen to this stream, I mean, we are right-wingers because we care for truth. We care for the higher cause. We care for that what is right, and we care for our own people, and we should stick to it. And we just need to have a long breath. But in the end, we will be right. And yeah, I'm pretty sure when we look at the catastrophic developments happening in this world, I'm pretty sure in the end, truth will be on our side and we will win. And each and every one of us needs to put a part to this pyramid of victory of the end. And that will be my final words. And thank you very much for having me on the stream.
You're very welcome, Stefan, and thank you for those optimistic words. I should say that you are the first Swiss German who has ever appeared on Millennial. So just something notable. So thank you especially for appearing. Lichtmes.
I take the order on my breast from now on. Okay. First Swiss ever appeared on Millennial Wolves.
All right, thank you. Lichtmes, any final words? And try to keep them optimistic.
Well, I just wanted to lament the fact how what a bad condition Britain, the British Islands are. But I say it to express my love, you know. I have always been Anglophile ever since I was a child, and I really care about England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. I mean, I have been only to England, but I love the country, I love the literature and culture, and I find it very, very painful to see the state Britain is in. So you have my heartfelt empathy and my, you know, European brotherhood like love. And I also want to mention that William Shakespeare was in fact Edward the Bear, and Stratfordians are really the scum of the earth. Sorry, it's an inside joke between us. Okay, but yeah. I really believe, check out Oxfordian theory. Okay, I red pill everybody of you about Shakespeare now. This is something important, you know.
Couldn't invite you on here without you bringing in your far-right conspiracy theories into it. Thank you very much, Lichtmes. He is a dedicated Oxfordian, and that's a whole thing. But anyway, let's end this one here before it tips over. So, all right, this has been the first Millennial Banquet. It's obviously a new format, and it will evolve as we go. But I think it was generally a great success. So thank you to all of you for taking part. And all right, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. I will be back very soon with the USA Banquet, which I imagine will be quite different. I'll see you all then. Thank you, and bye-bye for now.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.